Good morning. I'm Commissioner Mark Samulin, honored to be the chair of the Land Use and Sustainability Committee. I'm joined by my colleagues on the left, Commissioner Areola, as well as Commissioner Gongora. Today, October 19th, 9 o'clock, we will be kicking off our land use meeting. For those of you who are with us, we will, of course, have public comment. That's part of why we have these meetings as such. For those of you who are in the Zoom world, in our new hybrid world we live in, hopefully you have found your way to the Zoom ID, 850-5992-3037. And by phone, there are a couple numbers, but one of them is free, so I'm going to lead with the free one. It's 888-475-4499. We have a busy agenda, and I'm going to recognize Tom in just a second to see if there are any announcements that he wants to make. But I do want to just take a moment here as the chair. This is the last time this body will be getting together in this. And so I first want to thank all our city staff that have made our time together so productive, especially as our staff liaison, Tom Movie. And I want to recognize Commissioner Areola for his service ongoing as it is here on this committee. And I especially want to give a little shout out to Commissioner Gongora, who will be departing this committee at this moment in time, and just tell him how much of a pleasure it has been to serve with him, how grateful we are for his service, and we look forward to continuing to engage with him in the community. So, Michael, thank you for everything.
Thank you.
Okay. Tom, announcements, please.
Mr. Chair, just two announcements. Two items have been deferred to the December 2021 meeting. The first is the Ocean Drive MXE land use and zoning amendments. The second item is a discussion regarding the creation of a 6th Street overlay between Washington Avenue and Alton Road. Both of those items have been deferred and will not be heard today. There are two time certains. The first time certain, which will be the first item we take up, is item number 6 regarding the city's transition from grass leaf blowers. And then the second time certain is item number 11 regarding the city's proposal to amend the development regulations to discontinue motor scooter rentals as legal nonconforming uses. That's item number 11. That has a time certain of 10 a.m. And so those are the only announcements I had, Mr. Chair.
That's great. Thank you for that, Tom. So again, colleagues, we're going to start in any second here on item number 6 and talk about gas leaf blowers. We then also have our colleague, Commissioner Miner, who will be zooming in and has a few items. I believe they're 1, 12, and 13, so we'll be clicking through those. We're going to be sensitive to our public works team and try and do the best we can to front a few of their items as well so we can keep them moving. So with that, let's begin our meeting with item number 6, discussion of gas leaf blowers, potential opportunities to improve. I'm going to set the stage, and I welcome the co-sponsorship and comments of my co-sponsor, Commissioner Gongora, and Commissioner Steinberg, who is not with us. I'll recognize city staff. I also know Miami Beach United is here. Here's the headline. Gas leaf blowers have been a concern for our community. They're noisy. They're not the friendliest to our environment. And we've had a lot of discussion as to how we can move forward with these. In fact, this body, the commission, is on the record in 2017 to direct the administration to transition away from leaf blowers. And then we would not have leaf blowers, perhaps with the exception of a hurricane or a natural disaster. But basically, we've already done that. While this body has been talking about this, my position has always been straightforward, that the city should lead by example and that the city should get its house in order before we talk to the private sector. So, colleagues, we're now at that moment where I believe we're going to hear the city is very close to final transition, and I believe it is now appropriate, and it is my view that we should head towards, with a proper phasing, the elimination of gas leaf blowers. So with that intro, to my co-sponsor, would you like to add to that?
Sure. Thank you for setting this item up so well. I've been a long-time voice against leaf blowers. When I was on the commission last time, I sponsored the initial limitations on hours. I did not have the votes for a prohibition. Similarly, when I brought it back, I think with you again, to amend the hours, we didn't have the votes for a full-on ban, but we were able to restrict and limit them further. I'm hopeful today, after we hear from the administration and the public, that we're able to send this out with a favorable vote to the commission to do exactly what you just said and move forward with what we said we were going to do 4 years ago and prohibit them altogether, the gas leaf blowers. And I've asked legal as well, if possible, if this does pass, if we could get it out for first reading at the October 27th meeting, because I would love to be able to vote on this.
That's great. Thank you for that, Commissioner Gondor. Commissioner, do you want to be recognized first, or would you like to hear from the administration and the public?
Let's hear from the administration, yeah.
Okay, great. Amy, please.
Hi.
Our CRO, Amy Knowles.
Good morning, commissioners, and thank you. I'm happy to be here this morning as Interim Environment and Sustainability Director. So you definitely gave a great overview, commissioners. Overall, as an administration, we are recommending that an ordinance be put forward to ban the gas-powered leaf blowers. However, we do feel we need some time in order to establish the correct compliance approach, recognizing this is going to impact people's equipment and how they care for their properties. Overall, in terms of background, in September of 2017, we did pass a resolution to transition from the administration's perspective. And, you know, I'm happy to share that in spring of 2022, we will be fully transitioned away from gas-powered leaf blowers from the city's perspective. In addition, as you mentioned, leaf blowers are a major source of complaints of air pollution from combustion products and dust, noise pollution as well. There's a lot of options out there now in terms of different types of electric equipment that can be used. So there are many alternatives. There are quite a lot of cities, and in particularly the state of California, that is looking at banning the use of leaf blowers. So we do have a lot to learn from other cities as well. And with that, I'm happy to hear any feedback and discussion.
Yeah. Amy, just one question, then we're going to recognize MBU. Herb, if you want to come up. So if I heard you right, by spring of 2022, pick your month, May, June, the city is complete. The transition is over. The implementation of the 2017 statement from the commission will be fully implemented, again, with the exception of natural disaster or emergency. But we're basically done. Is that accurate?
Yes. I mean, that's what's been shared with us from our Public Works team. And
that's
I'm
fabulous.
Happy to invite Joe to say any more if he'd like to.
No, I think I see a nodding head. So nodding heads are great. That's great. So now we can shift gears because that's already happening. If we do nothing today, that's already done. But now we can shift gears to the private side. And I believe we've heard from MBU. We're going to hear from Herb. I think our Resident Sustainability Committee is also on the record. With that, Herb, you're recognized for up to 5 minutes.
Thank you and good morning, commissioners and distinguished panel. I'm Herb Frank. I live on Belle Isle, and I'm a board member of Miami Beach United, and I'm on the committee, which we started about 6 months ago, to investigate noisy gas leaf blowers. And what we found out was it's a lot more than just noise. So if you permit me, I'll read what I have to say. Let's see. On September 30th, we presented our ideas to the Residents Sustainability Committee. They unanimously voted to pass a motion to the city manager and commission suggesting a law be passed to ban all gas leaf blowers from being used in the entire city and replace them with electric leaf blowers. I believe the commissioners have received the letter from the city manager and the complete presentation that Miami Beach United created. As time for this topic is limited this morning, I would be happy to answer any questions or continue to provide some background information as to how MBU first got started to work on this issue. Thank you for allowing us to present to you, and hopefully you will be recommending to the City Commission that they pass an ordinance banning gas leaf blowers. By doing this, Miami Beach will become one of the leading cities in the country to move forward on improving the environment for all those who live, work, and visit our city. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, or I can continue giving you a little more information.
Thank you, Herbert. That was right to the point, and you're saving us a few minutes, so we appreciate it. Let's see. Anyone else from the public wants to be heard? Please come to the podium. Nick, at this moment, do we have anyone who has their hands raised for Zoom?
I see one hand on Zoom, Dave Dobler.
Okay. Let's recognize Dave for 2 minutes.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for taking up this item and giving me the opportunity to speak. Dave Buller, resident of 800 West Avenue. In 2017, when I was chair of the Citizens Sustainability Committee, we took up an item to ban gas-powered leaf blowers citywide, and everyone agreed that the city should take the first step before moving on to the private sector. A couple of interesting facts that we found when we were researching this. First is a new gas-powered unit produces as much emissions in 1 hour of operation as 11 new cars being driven for 1 hour. This ban will help improve our air quality and meet our climate change gas reduction goals. The EPA estimates that over 17 million gallons of fuel are spilled each year while refueling lawn equipment. And that's more than all of the oil spilled by the Exxon Valdez. So this affects Biscayne Bay water quality as that fuel will wash into the storm drain systems. And the total cost of ownership is significantly lower for electric equipment, which will increase the bottom line of the private sector who would be switching from this. Initially, our city staff was reluctant to switch, but they've made the switch and are seemingly happy with the new units. I love that our city's pilot went well, and it gives me confidence that a ban in the private sector will ultimately benefit our city as well as the private sector. So thank you very much.
Dave, thank you for your comments. Thank you for your leadership going all the way back to 2017. Nick, do we have anyone else from the public that wants to be recognized?
No one else right now.
So I'm going to bring it back to the virtual dais. We've heard from the city administration, who is successfully making this transition and is supportive of this direction in the private sector. We've heard from Miami Beach United, our residents, Sustainability Committee, Dave Dobler with the historical perspective from 2017. I also, and I hope my colleagues received a correspondence from the Belle Isle Residents Association. There may be more, but that's all that I have in front of me. So let me bring it up here. Who would like to be recognized? Commissioner Ariel.
Yeah, when we looked at this in the past, this goes back many years, staff had recommended against it, saying that it wasn't going to save us money and that the electric blowers didn't really reduce noise. Has something changed in the technology that they're not? Because for me, like, besides the environment, the number one complaint I hear, and I'm very sympathetic to, is the noise. Especially people start in the morning, it's extremely noisy. And I'm told, was told then, that the electric are not any more quiet. Is that the case?
Here come the answers, I think.
Yeah, Commissioner, I would invite Joe Gomez to come up and answer that. But I will say, when you do research, there are many different types of models, different types of force and strength, and different types of decibels. So it also kind of depends on the selection as well.
Good morning, Commissioners. Technology has changed a lot with these electric blowers. They're a lot more powerful and quieter than they were in the past. They carry a charge for a lot longer than before. So yes, we are recommending the electric ones because they are a lot quieter than the gas blowers. Gas blowers, by nature, the engine is very noisy.
All right, so that's good to know. So the technology has gotten to a point where they're quiet. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So we're not going to hear complaints from residents that
they're not going to be silent, of course, but they are going to be a lot quieter than the gas blowers. Yes, sir.
Okay, I have your word on that, because we were told just 2-3 years ago that there was no meaningful difference in decibel levels between electric and gas, which is what caused me to hesitate to do something that was not going to move.
My understanding is that technology has changed a lot over time, because a lot of municipalities, a lot of governments have been going to the electric system. So, yes, there has been substantial improvements, and I expect that over time additional improvements are going to be made in the technology.
Because in the past, you hear complaints from residents about the gas blowers, and then, you know, we've toyed with not allowing them at all. But then the issue becomes in neighborhoods with, you know, really great tree canopy, like the Flamingo Park neighborhood or even parts of the south of Fifth. You know, the leaves come down and they get underneath the cars, and there's just no way to get them. And so you need, you know, blowers to do that.
Yes.
So that's part of the reason we never banned them. But I'm happy to hear that the electric blowers are at a state now where they're a lot less noisy. So that's very promising. That's good news.
Okay. Other questions or comments from the dais? Okay. So again, colleagues, and for the record, the city is implementing what we directed them to do as a city administration by spring, call it June 2022, short of a natural emergency. The city of Miami Beach will no longer be using gas blowers. I sense by acclamation, and I'm going to recognize Nick in just a second, it is the will of this body to move this as quickly as possible for a prohibition on gas blowers citywide, including the private sector residents. That is the will of this body. And then what we would want to do is make sure that there is a proper phase-in so that we allow people that they know what's happening and they can adhere with the rules. Nick, you're recognized, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's actually exactly where I was heading, was if the committee directs us to draft legislation, the education and outreach period is going to be very important, because not just about as far as getting the word out, but to allow or give the commission to allow the opportunity for private individuals and landscaping companies to enjoy the benefit of the full useful life of any equipment they may currently have, and to upgrade to something that would be compliant. We think that that we would recommend including a phase-in period that would give private individuals and landscapers that opportunity. We'd like to work with staff. We don't believe that the 2 days between now and Thursday for the October agenda is going to be enough time to do that study of how long the average gas blower lasts, and to give, again, residents the time to exhaust their own equipment before they upgrade. But that would be our recommendation.
And Nick, I understand you're going to work closely with the city administration. Do we have any sense of sort of ballpark range, how quickly it might be, how long? Just to bring it to life, days, weeks, months, here, what are we talking?
I think we could have something for the next regular commission meeting with a schedule that's practical. Really, the big question is, what's the length of time for landscapers and residents to recoup the value of their investment? That's the big question.
And do we have any initial data or from benchmarks of other cities? What might that time frame look like? Just so there aren't surprises at first reading, what do we think that looks like?
Honestly, Commissioner, we need the time to look into it.
Okay.
I would be guessing, and I apologize. But we do want to learn from other cities. We want to be fair to people that have purchased equipment, give them notice, give them time, and make sure that they can transition properly.
Okay. So what I'm hearing, colleagues, is that it would move to the next full commission meeting, which is what date, Nick, just so everyone's tracking here, if we could?
It would be December, let's see, wait 1 second. December, I believe it's the 8th. It's the 8th,
okay.
Yeah.
So the next full business meeting for the commission, allowing the city administration, city attorney, to work through the phase-in plan required. Do any of my colleagues have any other comments, questions? Anyone want to add anything at this point?
I don't know. I mean, maybe you can just get back to me individually. Just with the decibel levels that we expect with the new electric.
We can probably get some information from our contractors, because our contractors for green space are already implemented the electric blowers.
Yeah, because, I mean, they're going to want to get an electric blower that's powerful enough to do the job. And so I'm just curious what that decibel level is compared to a gas.
We'll get back to you.
Okay, thanks.
So we're about to wrap this item on, and we're going to do exactly what was just described. I think by acclamation, we're going to move it to the December. So does anyone else want to be recognized? We're moving on here, but okay. Let's briefly, please, because we're about to move here.
Hopefully, I just wanted to say that the noise level continues to drop.
Yeah, no, you're fine. Just one-on-one.
Continues to drop and are down now to 65 decibels, dB. 65 is what they're down to. It's a lot less noisier than gas leaf blowers and a lot less noisier than the old electric ones.
Thank you, Herb. Sarah?
Yeah, I wanted to comment really quickly that California just passed a law that outlawed gas leaf blowers throughout the entire state. So we're kind of following behind them in that process. The other thing is I'm one of the few homeowners of the people that come up and talk against gas leaf blowers. So I have an entire suite of, you know, equipment for my yard. And I have an electric lawnmower. I have an electric leaf blower and a weed whacker. And I have to say that the noise that they make, the lawnmower, for example, is totally silent. And I love it. I mean, I can actually mow the lawn myself. Now I don't have to pay anybody to do it. Leaf blower, a little bit noisier, simply because it's like a hair dryer is basically what you're doing. You have a motor that's pushing out air, so it has to make some noise to be able to be. But I actually leaf blow my house. I have a lot of dogs, and so I leaf blow the hair right out the back door with it, and nobody ever complains about it inside my house. And the weed whacker also makes a little noise, but probably half of what a gas leaf weed whacker would make. So I'm hoping that eventually we move to electric for everything in terms of Miami Beach. But, you know, innovation has to catch up with it. We have to wind up getting, you know, the inventions created to be able to supply these kinds of equipment for the city of Miami Beach. But we're almost there. Thank you.
Thank you for the comments. Commissioner Gongora?
Just briefly, considering I've been to your beautiful backyard, I can't imagine you running around with a lawnmower, but I'm glad to hear that the electric is much less noisy, and I'm so excited to see this item finally moving forward. It is my hope, since I won't be here, that the administration comes back quickly. You see what other cities have done as far as notification, and that we finally get this done. I've been talking about leaf blowers on this dais at least since 2009, so I'm happy to see 12 years later that we're finally making positive movement towards electric.
Thank you for that. With that, and seeing no other comments, we will be closing the item by acclamation with the direction as given with the city attorney to work collaboratively with city administration to bring it to the December full business meeting, including the implementation plan as outlined. Okay. With that, we're going to try and take up, and if we, hopefully Commissioner Minor, are you with us in the Zoom world here, just to make sure?
I am. Thank you.
Wonderful. So we're going to try and click through three items as best we can, 1, 12, and 13. They're three different items, but they're all related to package stores. Commissioner Minor, you want to start at the top? Number one, is that where we're going to go here?
Yes. Thanks, Chair. I'll just tee up item number one first. So this is a proposed ordinance prohibiting new package store alcohol sales on the Alton Road corridor. This does not impact current existing uses. And just a couple of brief points on this. Package stores are prohibited in the entertainment district, so that there is a concern that potentially they could move to Alton Road. And we don't have an issue with all package store sales, so I don't like to lump everybody together. But we do have some issues with some package stores and what happens in and around the vicinity. The other thing is, especially along the Alton Road corridor, we do have an increased amount of tourists there. There are new hotels, restaurants, and so the concern would be that if there were to be an increase in the use of or in the number of alcohol package stores, it could have a negative impact on the surrounding neighborhoods, West Avenue, Flamingo Park, south of Fifth. So I've worked closely with Tom Mooney and Nick Clergis on this, and I guess I'll turn it over to Tom if he has any comments.
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner. That was a very good explanation. I don't have anything to add. The ordinance that is attached to this memo includes a prohibition of future package stores in the CD1 and CD2 districts in the Alton Road corridor. This was a dual referral to both the Land Use Committee and to the Planning Board. This is scheduled to be considered by the Planning Board at their meeting next Tuesday, and assuming that the Planning Board transmits it next Tuesday with a favorable recommendation, we would have zoning in progress, and then we anticipate first reading would be before the City Commission on December 8th. So I can certainly answer any questions that the committee may have.
Okay. We may have someone from the public, but if I might, we'll start here, and then we certainly will hear from Mr. Seraldo and others. Tom, I'm supportive of this item as is, and I know we've already done a dual referral, but I also want to make sure if there are any other areas that need to be addressed outside of the boundaries of Alton Road, that we explore that. So would the administration have any objections as a separate action to look citywide and see if there are other opportunities?
No, not at all. If you want, we could even bring it back to you at the next Land Use Committee with some suggestions if you wanted to bifurcate that as a separate discussion and continue it to the next Land Use.
Right. So, colleagues, my position is yes on number one. Let's support it with the additional direction as described by Tom. Commissioner Bongora, Ricky, do you want to?
Sure. I'll move what you just said.
Okay.
Yeah, look, I support it, and, you know, with your assistance, got past the prohibition on any more liquor stores in the MXC as well as Sunset Harbor. So, you know, I don't want to ban liquor stores throughout the city, but just sort of control how many we have and where they're located. So I just want to also just be judicious that we cautious that we don't overdo it. Mm-hmm. I'm very supportive of a thoughtful process to this. So I'll support it today.
That's great. So we're about to pass by acclamation. Daniel, you want a quick comment here?
Thank you. Yes, Daniel Seraldo with Miami Design Preservation League. I just want to mention about in the past that the City Commission put the zoning restriction for franchises on Ocean Drive, which I actually think if you all hadn't done that by now, we would have had like a McDonald's there. And I think Ricky was the one that brought that forward, Commissioner Areola.
I was.
So, yes. So, like, these are things that may not seem like a problem now, but if we plan in advance, we could prevent them from being problems in the future. So it sounds like a good idea. Thank you.
Okay. So, Tom, we're going to show that done by acclamation as described. Do you need anything else on that item, or are you good?
No, just to confirm on item number one, by acclamation, the Land Use Committee endorses the proposal.
Correct.
That's all I need.
And with the action that you mentioned about exploring
separate
the other
action,
areas coming back.
That was a separate motion, and we'll bring that back as a separate discussion at your next meeting.
Okay. Commissioner Minor, next up, I believe you have item number 12.
Yes, thank you. So this item is a potential amendment to the minimum distance requirement between retail stores primarily selling alcohol beverages. But the amendment is not the current minimum distance is 1,500. But there is a potential exception that the planning board, through its conditional use process, could lower that distance to 700 feet. This item just takes away the planning board's authority to reduce the distance to 700 feet. And it keeps the existing regulation of 1,500 in place. And again, work with Tom and Nick on this, and I'll turn it over to Tom.
That's correct. Under Chapter 6 right now, the minimum distance separation is 1,500 feet. When that was adopted a few years ago between first and second reading, the provision that allowed the planning board the ability to reduce that by up to 800 feet was placed within the ordinance. The proposal here would be essentially to remove that, so it would be a hard 1,500-foot separation with no ability to either vary from that or to reduce that. Staff is supportive of this. We were supportive of the 1,500 feet when it came before the commission originally a few years ago, and we are supportive of this proposal. If this does clear the committee, since this is a non-LDR amendment, we would bring it to the commission for first reading in December.
Colleagues, questions or comments here, or should we see if anyone from the public? Nick, anyone from the
public? No, I don't have anyone on Zoom.
Tom, I just to clarify on this and maybe a related question through all of this. So basically it's 1,500 today. This doesn't change it. It basically says the planning board cannot modify it.
Correct.
Okay. And is there any modifications? Could a modification be brought recommended by the planning board to the commission? Could the commission modify, or no, full stop, 1,500?
As proposed herein, it would be 1,500, period. Obviously, if the commission wanted to propose something different at first reading, they could certainly do that. But as drafted, there would be no ability to modify the 1,500 feet.
And I'm comfortable and today supportive of what's in front of us. My question is, we're making some headway on new stores. We're talking about limiting the exceptions for distance. What about areas where we got too many of them already? And we just have too many and they're problematic. So they're probably grandfathered in. You know, I think if I heard my colleague, I tend to think of the MXE, Ocean, Collins, Washington as one area. What do we have on the table for that?
I think that with regard to areas where you may see an over-concentration or saturation of these uses, it's difficult to remove them because they have grandfathered status. We could explore potentially an amortization. However, that could end up being tricky, and that's more of a long-term type of mechanism to deal with that. Another option that we could use, that we have used in the past, is to further reduce hours of operation for existing stores. That's something that I believe, and Nick, correct me if I'm wrong, that the commission does have some latitude to apply retroactively reductions in hours of operation.
And that's so right, Tom.
That's something that the commission can certainly explore in those areas of the city where there is an over-concentration or saturation.
Right.
So, colleagues, again, I'm ready to support item 12 as is, but with additional direction for the administration and the city attorney's office to collaboratively review opportunities to address areas such as, you know, Ocean, Collins, Washington, that area particularly, that may have an over-concentration by doing exactly what you said, either hours, amortization, or any other creative idea. Tom, did you want to pick up?
Yeah, I wanted to mention that, as you may recall, Mayor Gelber had made a proposal to expand the earlier closing time to areas that were just north of the Art Deco Cultural District. And that was not approved by the City Commission in March. However, the mayor has indicated that he would like to bring that back. We did draft an ordinance that would further reduce the hours in certain areas of the city that are north of the Art Deco Cultural District. However, because of the pending litigation that the city is in, we decided that it would be best to let that litigation, that separate litigation regarding hours of operation for alcoholic beverage establishments, to play out before we brought back any further legislation that would reduce the hours for package stores. Nick, anything that I said that was incorrect? Or
no, Tom, that's exactly right. And that separate ordinance was drafted to address areas immediately adjacent to the entertainment district where we'd already reduced hours. So it would make those districts consistent.
Okay. So, colleagues, what's on the table, approving item 12, but also directing the administration again to look at hours, to look at amortization in the areas where there's an over-concentration. So do either of you want to be recognized? Thoughts on that as a potential motion or action today?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Miner has his hand up on Zoom.
Let's recognize the sponsor.
I was just going to add, my colleagues know this, but you know, I think the importance of this is the conditional use authority that the planning board has is not reviewable by the commission. So, you know, we lose a little bit of authority if we don't close the loophole. Not that they would do it, but we do lose that authority to oversee it.
Thank you, Commissioner Miner. My colleagues here have a thought or want to entertain a motion as I describe.
I mean, again, I've been a sponsor of this kind of legislation in the past, particularly in areas where we've had problems, particularly the MXE, and where we don't want to see an over-proliferation, such as, you know, small neighborhoods like Sunset Harbor. So I think, you know, I just caution us to be measured in our approach as we do this because, you know, there are some really delightful liquor stores that, you know, serve the community. In my own neighborhood, we have a great one. South of Fifth has a great one, and there's many throughout the city. So I just want to urge us to be cautious as we
proceed along these lines to not overdo it. And then just to think about, you know, other requirements we might impose or ask of future, you know, liquor stores. You know, do they have to provide, you know, some kind of food or other type of services as part of their retail operation? One of the businesses that we collectively have had our eye on and passed legislation on are, you know, let's call them pharmacies without naming the names, that are really nothing more than liquor stores themselves, particularly in MXC, where, you know, 50% of their sales is beer and wine, but, you know, they've got these huge name brands. But in our city, they're not selling, household goods. They're selling liquor. So, you know, I also want to be cautious about, you know, those kinds of operations as they try to grow elsewhere in our city, because they're just liquor stores by another name.
Yeah, I think there's just some great comments, Commissioner Arriola. One, measured, and today it's about really, I think, direction to explore your comments about places, and we would encourage the administration, city attorney's office, to take a broad view of what we're talking. We're talking about stores selling alcohol. They might be traditional package stores, but if I hear my colleague right, there may be other types of stores that are contributing, and we would like a broader view of that. Commissioner Gongora, as defined here, are you okay with all of this, or do you have something else you want to add?
No.
No? Okay. So, Tom, I think you have direction by acclamation supporting item number 12, as Commissioner Minor described, with the additional direction. Is there anything else you need from us at this point?
On the additional direction, is that something that you want us to bring back to the commission as part of first reading of this for informational purposes, or is that something you'd like to discuss as part of a land use discussion?
My preference is to bring it here. I'd like to maybe see it and see where that leads first.
Okay. So the previous item, this will be two parts. One is the administration and the city attorney's office will look at hours and amortization for other areas of the city and bring that back to the land use committee as a separate discussion. And then the second part would be by acclamation supporting the proposal herein, which we will then bring to the city commission for first reading.
Great. Show it done. Commissioner Minor, item number 13, I believe, is your final one.
Yes, and thank you, Chair. Yeah, so this is just really to clarify our code and make it expressly clear that when we have hours for package liquor sales, that also applies to deliveries. So this item does not seek to change the hours of packaged liquor store sales, but in talking with again, Tom and Nick, it appears that our code does restrict the deliveries to the hours of sales, but it's not crystal clear, and this would make it crystal clear. So I'll turn it over to Tom.
That's correct. Right now, under the code, the way that we've been applying the code, when situations like this arise, is people that may do deliveries from their package stores, their hours of operation would have to mirror their in-store hours of operation. So in other words, if a liquor store in the MXE area has to close at 8 p.m., they can't do deliveries until 2 a.m. And that's how we apply the code now. However, technically, it doesn't say that explicitly. And we think, we agree with Commissioner Minor that it would be a good idea to codify that. So if anybody in the future tried to challenge that, it would be very clear that if they have a delivery component, they cannot deliver past their in-store hours of operation.
Nick.
And I would just add, Mr. Chairman, we've drafted this so that it would apply equally to package stores, which is retail stores that primarily sell liquor, but also to other stores, including grocery, convenience stores, and gas stations that incidentally serve liquor. So it would apply equally to both.
And just a couple clarifying questions, because if I understand right, what we're talking about is delivery hours must be in sync with operating hours. Two questions. One, are we talking beer, wine, liquor, all of the above?
This would just be for package stores. So it would be a store that primarily sells alcoholic beverages. They require a separate license. this would not apply to retail sales as part of a larger store, like, say, a Publix or a Whole Foods.
Okay. Tom, I think if you take a look at 6-3A2, the amendments for retail stores, including grocery, convenience stores, and gasoline service or filling stations, track the same.
Okay. I stand corrected.
Okay. So it's all the types of stores.
Right.
And then is it all the types of alcohol, beer, wine, liquor, everything?
That's how it's drafted. 6-3A2 includes sales of beer and wine.
Okay. I think that clarifies my question. Again, I'm personally supportive. My colleagues, or Nick, do we have anyone on Zoom that has comments?
I don't see anyone on Zoom, except for Commissioner Minor.
Okay. Hang tight, sponsor. Let's see if my colleagues have questions. No? Okay. So we don't see it. So I think the concept on the table, colleagues, is to favorably accept this and send it to the commission.
Move it.
So there's a motion. Commissioner Arioli, are you okay with that? Yep. Great. So we'll show that done by acclamation. Commissioner Minor, anything else you want to say? I believe those are all your items, correct?
Yeah, no, thank you, and thank you for allowing me to speak on this. Yeah, just a clarifying item, questions for Nick and Tom. So is this apply to convenience stores, fulfillment centers? Basically, does it apply across the board?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and part of my concern in bringing this item is we've been hearing a lot about short-term rentals, and my concern was that if you have this potentially 24/7 delivery, which, that could impact and just cause more problems with the short-term rentals. So, okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Minor. Let's go to item number 7. We had a request from the administration to see if we could front-load a few of the public works-related items. I'll tee up number 7. And then we'll invite Joe and team. Flooding is a big deal in our city, has been for a long time. And as we talk about climate change, the sea level rise, there's all sorts of impacts. But one of the biggest ones is the water, and that's really a prime concern. We know we have a set of neighborhood improvement projects. We are working those. Those are large, complex projects, cost a lot of money. And as you look at our schedules, many of those projects are not going to be implemented for quite a ways out. And so this item says, keep doing what you're doing in that front. That's all fine. We're on a path. We're working it. We're improving as we go. But says, what do you say to the neighbors who aren't going to get that project anytime soon? Are there things we can do in the interim? Are there solutions to build on that? And I think some good news today that it looks like we may be hearing about some new ideas here. Joe.
Thank you, Commissioner Samuel. Yes, so we're taking a little holistic approach on our stormwater solutions. So I've directed our team to look at a potential short-term and interim solutions for nuisance-type flooding, which we know commonly occurs, particularly in the summertime. These solutions, I do want to make sure that everybody understands, they are not the ultimate solution. They won't be the ultimate solution, but they will provide some sort of level of relief. And I think that's important. So I've directed the team. We are going to be coming back to you in 120 days, in about 4 months, with a recommended list of potential projects with some sort of level of cost associated with that, and then develop the implementation plan when we can start rolling some of these out. And some of these we can do through our pool of contractors, things like that. So I believe that this is a way to be able to address some of the hot spots, what we call the hot spots, the concerns that we have out there in terms of just ponding and some short-term flooding during our storm events. And again, I do want to emphasize these will not be the ultimate. They won't get us to that level. Those are part of the neighborhood improvement projects. But again, they will help.
That's great, Joe. One comment and a question. You know, we had some spirited discussion at the commission about the Palmview neighborhood.
Yes, sir.
And that's an area particularly where they're looking for solutions. We had some discussions about their status as historic preservation. So as we assess potential hotspots, I would just ask that we give a special attention to them. Pardon. And second, could you just confirm, I believe it came up in sort of initial discussions, briefings, that the city years ago had a program like this, sort of hot spots where we were trying to address. Is that accurate?
Yes, sir. That is correct. So this is almost kind of like re-energizing that program, but we're taking it to the next level. So what we want to do is come back to you with a plan of a list of projects and attached some potential costs with them, and then we can start prioritizing which are the ones that we can implement and get those out there as quickly as possible.
Well, that's great. I'm very excited about this because this will give us an opportunity to deliver more solutions to more areas quicker. So that is great. It's exactly what, as the sponsor, I had in mind. 12 days sounds reasonable. But I think it's 120.
120 days.
12 sounded really good, but I sense 120. Colleagues, questions, thoughts? Otherwise, I want to say that we're on the path here, and we'll look forward to the update. Anything to add, edit, delete? No. Seems like everyone's okay. Nick, anyone from the public?
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't see anyone on Zoom.
Okay, so Joe, we accept what you got, and we'll see you in 120 days.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Joe, while you're still with us,
yes, sir. Absolutely.
You also have item number.
I think he had number 5, number 3, and then time permitting number 4.
3, 5, and 4. Let's take 3 first, and I know we might want to hear from CIP David. If it was on number 3, this is our standing item for updates. First Street. So question, 50,000 feet, what is the status of the project?
The good news is we've completed negotiations with our consultant. We've negotiated a price of just slightly under $5.9 million. We're working right now through the purchase order process, and we expect to give Jacobs an NTP November. Start the design process, and the design process will be approximately 24 months to complete the design and then go to construction.
And I assume early and often they'll be engaging with the community, the South of Fifth residents, the SOFNA board. That's part of what they're going to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely, okay. Commissioner. That's all built into the design fee.
Okay. That sounds helpful. Let's jump over to West Avenue. Just couple questions here. First, for residents who just know, what is the status of West Avenue? When does construction begin? David, what would you share?
Certainly. Good morning, Commissioner. We're in the final permitting phase with the county, with DERM, for the necessary permits to begin the installation of water, sewer, and storm systems. The time frame that we're looking at starting is end of November. That is when we're looking to break ground. The work will commence, as you've been hearing now for some time. We're using the segmented approach. So we're going to begin segments 1 and 2 in the north section, which is the area north of 14th Street, and on segment 1 in the section south of 14th. And the section 1 and 2 in the north, one of them is really only exclusive to the area where the pump station installation would start in the parking lot. And then the other section 2 is most of Lincoln Road and some of the connecting side streets. So that would be where we would start the work.
So November for segment, November 2022.
November 29, which is kind of the earmark date, but in that time frame.
Now, I recall one of the learnings from the Inspector General work and the Palm and Hibiscus is that we want to have harmonization agreements to make sure that we have alignment with the community. What is this? How many harmonization agreements do we need? How many do we have signed?
Sure. For these first segments that I just described, we're looking at between the two, and I'll talk about them in terms of the whole contract. There's 25 properties impacted. Of the 25 properties, we need 22 of the 25 would need some form of a harmonization license agreement. The other three are not impacted sufficiently that would require any type of work on their private property. Of those 25 properties that I described, we have two license agreements in hand that have been executed by the property owners. So that leaves 23 properties that we're still working with. They've all been provided the full packages. There's a couple of properties that asked for some additional consideration, so we have made those changes and provided it to our friends at Public Works to look at, make sure they agree with the design change. So, but ultimately, a resolution would have to be, would have to come to a resolution with every single property prior to breaking ground. And the resolution could be, one, they execute the agreement, they agree on what we're going to do on their private property to harmonize, or they may not. If they don't, then the design builder, per contract, required to perform some level of redesign within the public right-of-way to, at the best they can, accommodate the required harmonization within the public right-of-way.
So just to see if I understand, we're targeting the end of November. That's when we're going to break ground segment one. Some 20-plus are still outstanding, a couple in hand. So if I'm looking at my calendar saying it's October 19th, we're probably in a pretty big full-court yes. press in the next 4 to 6 weeks to try and engage the community, make sure everyone understands, and try and get these signed or do something different like you described. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. So the plan that we have right now is we have a letter, notice of license agreement signature deadline that would be issued no later than 30 days prior to the projected date that we would break ground. So 30 days before, let's just assume it's the 29th of November or thereabouts, 30 days before, the property owner that has not executed an agreement, we provided a letter saying, you know, we've met with you, you know, so many times, we've provided this, we haven't heard from you. Please let us know what your intention is within 2 weeks. So that letter will give them 2 weeks to basically tell us what is it they want to do, or they basically are taking a hard stance on saying no, not wanting anything on their property. That would allow the design builder to modify the design adjacent to their properties prior to construction.
Okay, thank you for that. And I know there's been some questions raised by the residents. I know they've reached out to the administration and as well as my office for some additional clarifications. And I know we're actually in a scheduling loop to do some of that. But that answers everything I had on my agenda. So, colleagues, unless anyone has something to say on item three, we are going to conclude this discussion for today. That was helpful. Looking to my colleagues, looking at the clock, seeing we are getting very close to 10 o'clock. Welcome, Commissioner Richardson. And my watch is 10 o'clock, but we'll get there. So item three is concluded for today. Thank you for those updates. We had a request for time certain. Nick, keep me honest here. My clock is saying we're 9:59 and something here.
I have the same. I have 10 o'clock.
You have 10 o'clock. Yes. Okay. So then I'd like to call up, as agreed, item number 11, which is a discussion as an amendment to the city's land development regulations to discontinue motor scooter rentals. Commissioner Gongora is a co-sponsor, and I've also made a request to be a co-sponsor of this item. But with that, Commissioner Richardson, would you like to introduce the item?
Yes, and thank you, Chairman, and I very much appreciate the time certain. So good morning, colleagues. This item, actually, I started working on in December with the idea that if we eliminate the motor scooters, we might be able to improve public safety. So this was a public safety measure. From my perspective, in December, I was urged by the city attorney's office to, be patient and collect some data. So we've been collecting data at the police department and so forth about the scooter rentals for some time now. and I'm prepared to move forward with this discussion and see how my colleagues feel about it. So with that, I think we have someone from the city attorney's office that I would, with your indulgence, would like to present. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Mark Fishman, city attorney's office, and what Commissioner Richardson said is accurate. What the city would be looking to do would be gradually discontinue or amortize motor scooter rentals as a non-conforming use within the city, and we'd be doing this by amending the city's land development regulations. Presently, Section 142-3 prohibits throughout the city, in all zoning categories, the rental or lease of various sort of toy vehicles, including golf carts, low-speed vehicles, mopeds, motorcycles powered by less than 50 cc's, motorized bicycles, and motorized scooters. Obviously, this body and the entire city commission has endeavored for many years, you know, by passing various ordinances to try and ameliorate and get under control a lot of the reckless, illegal, dangerous conduct exhibited by motor scooter rental riders, which has resulted in just many, many violations. And, you know, I don't have to repeat them all, but you all prohibited overnight rentals, capped the fleet of any business entity at a maximum of 25 vehicles. You've ordered the installation of EPO, emergency power off devices, onto the scooters, had 24-hour hotline numbers where someone from the scooter companies must be available to turn it off if police or code call them because it's being operated recklessly. You know, and despite this, like Commissioner Richardson said, I think the city records still demonstrate that there is this bad, this illegal, this reckless conduct still continues. Obviously, the city is very geographically small, but we're a huge tourist destination. I don't know, maybe 12 million or whatever visitors annually, many looking for a good time and just to play around on these vehicles. Obviously, individuals who rent motor scooters, as opposed to maybe residents who own them and drive them and use them to commute, are typically inexperienced scooter drivers looking for amusement. Their driving often puts residents and visitors, both pedestrians on bicycles and other vehicles, in dangerous situations. Not to mention our city police and code have been having difficulty coping and even catching up to a lot of these scooters, given their maneuverability, ability to weave in and out of traffic. And essential police, city police, and code enforcement resources have been utilized trying to get this under control and are being drained somewhat. So despite all your best efforts, it appears the problem continues. So what we'd be looking for today is, you know, should this committee be in support of this initiative, what we'd recommend is continuing this item for the city attorney's office. Nick and I are working on this, along with the planning department, to bring this back to you for a progress update at a future land use meeting. And what we do is, in the interim, the city attorney's office, the administration, we'd identify and try and engage a consultant. And what this consultant would do would help us to determine the appropriate length of time, the amortization period, which will take into account all sorts of various factors pertaining to the existing motor scooter rental businesses, and develop that record as to the value of their investment, and provide them with a reasonable time frame to recoup their investments. So that is what we'd work on. We'd also work to further develop our record regarding the continued illegal, dangerous conduct. I know police put out an LTC, I think it was in June. And we'd also have them, set forth the resources, the police and code resources that have been utilized attempting to remediate and enforce this type of behavior by the scooter operators. So if you have any questions, but that's
Chairman, if I could just add a
question. Please.
Thank you so much. This, for me, is about public safety. It really is. Another item related to it is as we continue to go green in the city, this will reduce our carbon footprint. But that alone is not enough, because these are legal vehicles. But this, for me, is a public safety issue. And I remember when I first came to the city 25 years ago, there were none of these rental operators. And this has nothing to do with the residents. Residents can continue to buy and operate their motor scooters. But what I've observed personally is typically what happens is they get rented as a group. And so you might see four scooters together. I saw actually one day a few months ago 20 scooters moving in a pack. And so weaving in and out of traffic and so forth, it really has become a public safety, and we've collected quite a bit of data on this. And so, but I'm here to listen, and I want to see what you all think about this. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner Richardson. And I would just add, and then I'll open it to my colleagues and the public. I agree with you. It's a public safety issue. I've seen the groups. I would also add it's a resident quality of life issue. They're noisy. They're getting in the way. They're contributing to an environment that sometimes residents use the term chaotic. You know, as we have spirited discussions of the future of Ocean Drive, one of the concerns I hear from a lot of people, you know, if we bring the cars, they worry a little bit about cars, but they worry a whole lot about scooters and slingshots and all that. Not to go down that path per se, but sometimes the scooters are more scary than the cars. So I agree with you. It's a public safety issue. It's a quality of life issue, and I'm today prepared to support the actions described to continue the process. But let me hear from my colleagues if they want to add edit to that conversation. Commissioner Ariola.
I mean, as it goes to the issue of noise, I mean, more and more of these things are becoming electronic and e-scooters, so I don't know that that's, you know, a compelling reason to ban or restrict them. We'll just see more and more e-scooters. That's just the way that it's going. One of my concerns here, among many, is, you know, transportation, you know, for sort of the last mile for our residents that are trying to go to and from work or to do errands. You know, the city bike has been wildly successful, and if you look down in Brickell and downtown, a lot of people get around on those little e-scooters. You know, What's your vision for dealing with that? Because I'm definitely open to that kind of concession throughout the city where people can rent them, you know, to do their little trips and get to and from work. It takes cars off the road, which is consistent with our environmental and, you know, pedestrian first policies. So I want to, you know, be very careful here that we're not doing something that actually is inconsistent with our transportation plans. So does anyone have an idea? Do you have a vision for that?
Chairman, can
and, please.
And thank you, Commissioner Ariola. So I want to be very clear that what I'm attempting to do is target a public safety issue that is primarily created by people visiting our city with these short-term rentals. So I have two plans that I'm bringing forth, and I'm glad that we're here in the sunshine because I can talk about it. I haven't talked about it. So the last mile that you speak of, we are having more and more delivery trucks coming into our city. So one of the companies that I've been talking with over the last 8 months is a company called Reef, who is utilizing underutilized parking garages and parking spaces. And they are now piloting some last-mile delivery services. So one of the things that I'm envisioning is us possibly having a last-mile delivery station, if you will, where packages can come into one central location and very quickly be moved out with the last mile, either with these electric carts and some other things. So that's one thing I'm looking at. And the other thing that I'm looking at for our residents on commuters is, you know, I've requested the commission to look at doing an exemption on electric bikes if it's a city concessionaire. So we are, we, because of our public safety measures, have banned some of these new toys for purposes of our visitors. But I believe there's a place, in addition to the city bike program, I believe there's a place to have some electric bikes in the city. I have an idea of that they should be in garages and not on the streets, because we have our city bike program on the street in racks, and I don't want more of that there. But that's another plan that I have for how residents could get around on electric bikes And I'm hoping to move that forward as well so that we can do just what you said, and that is eliminate cars from the street. So all I want to do today is to move this forward to the next step, and that is to look at what would be an appropriate amortization period. Because I'm not looking to financially harm these businesses. I'm looking for a legitimate workout. I'm looking to leave them whole at the end of the day. They've rented spaces. They've bought scooters for, I think it's Fort Walton Beach. Is that, do I have that?
No, Panama City Beach.
Panama City Beach. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Panama City Beach did this when they realized that they had a problem in their community. And their period was 3 years. Our period might be 2.5 years. It might be 4 years. I don't know. But I'm just hoping we can at least keep the conversation alive and move it forward. I hope that answers your questions, Commissioner Areola.
Commissioner Gongora.
Yes, thank you. As I understand it, this is just to do the study to see about discontinuing motor scooter rentals, right? This doesn't have anything to do with motor scooter ownership. Is that correct?
Correct.
That's right.
That's right, because, and by the way, I don't think we could do the latter because I believe state law preempts us on that, but... This is, and if we didn't have a compelling reason to do it, I don't think we could do it in the first instance. It's just because of a public safety issue.
Okay. I guess my question is that right now, electric bike ownership is legal, correct? It's only electric bike rentals that are prohibited except through a city vendor. Is that correct?
Yeah, electric bikes are like if you personally wanted to buy an electric bike, you could do that, and that won't be affected by this.
Okay. My view, because I agree with you on one thing and I disagree with you on the other, I'm not a fan of scooters. I do agree that there's a proliferation of them throughout the city. We're not stopping people from buying them if they want to buy them and use them for their own personal use. This item, and the reason why I was supportive about it, is it had to do with rentals, which to me is vacationers that are coming here and packing them on and, you know, going all over town, and we see them having fun and unfortunately clogging our roads. So I think that this study is worthwhile because it would eventually cause less to be rented in the city. The current companies would become legal non-conforming, and eventually, if they chose not to continue, would put less of these on the roads. The reason I disagree with the electric bike item, and I know that it was continued till December, and I won't be here, but I'll give you my 2 cents since Please. I'm sitting here and it came up now. I voted against it at Neighborhoods Committee because it will put more electric bikes on the road, whereas this one diminishes items. That one puts more on. And I'm completely in favor of people having electric bikes, using them to get to wherever they need, bike the final mile. I think that the current vendor of the city can introduce them and may be introducing them. I'm not 100% sure. But as I understand your item, we would legalize putting more electric bikes for rent. And to me, that's going to be more driven by tourists, I believe, than by residents, and just put more electric vehicles on the road. So I wouldn't support that if I were sitting here in December, but I won't be. But I've just put my thoughts out there.
Well, Chairman, may I? And thank you for the comments. Let me respond to give you some comfort. First of all, I have to change what we blocked to allow the city to have a concession or even to consider it, okay? And my goal is to take cars off the street. So that program, the way I would structure it, and I've talked to one company, but if we do it, it'll be a competitive procurement. The way I would structure that deal is to make it cost prohibitive for anyone to use electric bikes for extensive periods of times, which means I take the toy off the street and make it available for commuters. So, for example, the average commute time on an electric bike is about 20 minutes. So if someone wants to rent one for 3 hours, we could make that cost prohibitive. But for 20-minute rides, we could make it very economical. And so I appreciate your concern, but I would counter to say that it will actually take cars off the street because, for example, I live in Flamingo Park. If I could get on an electric bike, even in a suit, because I don't want to sweat riding a bike, even though I might need the exercise, right? I could get over here to City Hall in probably 10 minutes, and I would leave my car at home. So this would be, if I'm able to even look at the program, it would be targeted at residents commuting, and I would make it cost prohibitive to be a toy.
Okay. I think those are good speaking points and warrant future debate by the commission and looking into. But I've never seen you riding a bike now. And you could easily have an electric bike. You could buy one. You could take it to City Hall. You could take it to dinner. You could take it to Macy's. You could go lots of places, but you don't. And I think a lot of times these speaking points sound good, but they don't, in fact, reduce people using their cars. They just put more things on the street. And while younger people, let's say our age sitting here and younger, might be encouraged to ride these types of devices, a lot of the seniors that have their cars aren't going to stop taking their cars to be on a bicycle, is the unfortunate reality that I've seen. But I do like the idea of less cars on the street, whatever we can do to do that. I agree with that sentiment. I'm just cautious when I start hearing about adding devices to the street, whether it in fact will clog traffic more and have the opposite effect of what's intended.
I appreciate that. And I would invite you to come biking with me sometimes. I bike on Saturday morning. I own two bicycles, and I'm also a member of City Bike. So I use all three, and I own two bikes, a mountain bike and a cycling. So come cycling with me Saturday morning.
I'll take you up. Give me a call.
Perfect.
Okay, bringing us back to the item, if I could, here. Nick, do we have anyone from the public?
I see no one online with their hands up.
Okay, and just a question. Is there a financial ask for incremental dollars on top of the budget?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe so. I think that we would follow the approach that Panama City Beach used. They hired a forensic accountant who did a very specific study that we're not aware of anyone else who's done. So our first step would be to request a proposal from this accountant. But we expect that to be well within the manager's purchasing authority.
Okay, so we don't have an incremental ask. I'm aware of a forensic accountant, but he seems pretty busy now, so we're going to have to go find someone else. Again, I'm going to support this today. Did you want to be recognized, Commissioner Arriola?
Just to be clear, so current businesses that are renting these, they're grandfathered in, and then we'll amortize them out. They'll phase out. They can't replace their fleet. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then basically, over time, there'll just be a prohibition against these. And then you're saying you're going to bring back something for us to look at that would allow for, let's call them e-scooters, that will address my concern to have transportation available, particularly for our residents or people who want to do short commutes. I see it all the time. I mean, I encourage you to sit at a restaurant right when they open. The number of people that work in the restaurant that ride in these e-scooters, I think most of them are personal because you can fold them up and, you know, stash them anywhere. But it's becoming more and more common, and I think that's a good thing. So I don't want to do something that would be inconsistent with the policy of this commission to try to get, you know, cars off the road and to be, you know, more pedestrian friendly. I mean, if we all rode bike and took e-scooters and less cars, that would be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're going to bring something?
I have an item now I'm working on. If we can amend the ordinance where we closed out e-bikes, but I want to amend the city ordinance to allow a city concessionaire for that purpose, and it's specifically targeted to the residents and for commuter purposes, and I have to get the one step done before I can get to step two, but my proposal in step two would make it targeted to residents and make it cost prohibitive for our visitors to rent these as toys.
Okay, I mean, City Bike now, I mean, I haven't been on one in a bit, but they're for limited duration as well. I think they're like an hour or so, and then you got to, you know, put them back in and take them back out. So they're, you know, they're really meant for short distance and that kind of thing. And the technology exists with these e-scooters to do exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, there's a company, Wheels, that is operating in Miami. And I'm not promoting that one company. I'm promoting the concept. And whatever we do, I would hope that we would make it a competitive procurement and give everybody an opportunity. But that's really a program that is targeted at taking cars off the road and helping residents move about.
Okay.
And by the way, this is not a final approval that we're going to do this. This is just a next step that we're going to get a consultant. We're going to look at it. Maybe the consultant is going to give us some advice that it's a 4-year amortization, 3-year, and then it's going to come back here for another consideration. And then it would have to go to the commission.
Thank you for that, Commissioner Richardson. Colleagues, any objections to continuing this process? Anyone else want to be recognized?
I'm okay with continuing. I'm iffy on this item, but since we're still going to be looking at it, I'll support it today.
Tom, do you have everything you need to move on to our next item?
Nick, Mark, are you guys good?
I think we're good. Mr. Chairman, I do see one individual with a hand up.
If it's for this item... if we can clarify just to our caller, we welcome your comments. We're just concluding item 11. If you have comments on item 11, 2 minutes, please.
Hi, hello?
Hi,
hello? We can hear you.
Yes, hi, my name is Ilan Atun, and I'm owner of one of the rental company in Miami Beach. And I have three things to say to Mr. Richardson about public safety that he say. First, I don't think there is any public safety after all the restriction that you guys put on the scooter rental by limit to 25 vehicles and no rental overnight and no rental after 7 p.m. and shut off. In the past 3 months, I don't have even one phone call from the police, from the city, the police department about shutting off any of my vehicles or any reckless driving or, thank God, no accident, no any incident. And I talked to all my colleagues, all my other scooter company. They say that very, very, very few phone calls in the past 3 months. And the other things that I wanted to say, it's about the electric scooters, the stand-up one that all over Miami that he say. I think this is much, much, much worse than our regular scooters, because I read the article about the doctor from the ER that he say there's so many accidents with the head injury, with the face injury, with those electric scooters and bikes that cost so many injury and so many, the increase by 30 or 40% of the ER injury from face and head injury from those electric vehicles that you guys talking about. And Fort Lauderdale shut them down. New York City shut them down. All over Europe, they start to limit those vehicles because there's so many injury. And this is a really public safety because kids driving them all over the sidewalk, between cars, everywhere. And I don't think the regular people, the regular good customer renting and driving to have fun, to explore the city and see sightseeing, I don't think this is a public safety. We follow all the laws. We ask for driver license. We rent only for over 18 years old. And it's pretty... We try to do the best to limit and to keep the city safe. I live in Miami Beach in the past 25 years, and I have this business since 95. So if Mr. Richardson said there's no scooters business then back then...
Thank you, sir. Your 2 minutes are up.
Thank you for those comments, and also thank you for that anecdotal feedback that some of the actions we have been taking have impacted public safety. That's actually very encouraging and very appreciative of those comments. So, colleagues, I think we're ready to conclude this conversation on item 11. I believe there is support to continue the process. Nick, you...
I have one more caller.
Okay.
Dave Dobler.
Okay. Dave's recognized.
Dave, you have 2 minutes.
Yep.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I've done a lot of traveling, and
I love renting scooters. They're a very convenient way for getting around town, seeing the city. They don't take up a lot of space. You're outside in the sun. Personally, I actually like renting scooters. I think the problem that we have here is that we're trying to just ban an entire industry because we have a law enforcement issue with some people being reckless. So I'm actually not really too sure that this is going to solve any real problem. What are people going to do? You know, what are tourists going to do to get around? They're going to have to take Lyft or Uber. They're going to rent a car. They're not going to be able to see the entire city. I'm not so sure that, like, I know when we want to reduce speeding down Alton Road, we put a police checkpoint and radar and we ticket people. We don't ban cars. So I'm not actually sure what we're going to actually accomplish by eliminating a way for people to get around and have fun. So those are my comments.
Thank you. We have one individual, David Soares, you're recognized.
Thank you. I've lived in Miami Beach for well over 10 years. And over the last couple of years, I've realized that, or I've seen with my own two eyes, that scooter rentals are a public safety issue. And especially since COVID, everyone comes down to Miami Beach to party. And what happens is you have rows of people that just rent four or five dozens of scooters at a time, and they pack more than one person on a scooter, believe it or not. And they're weaving in and out of traffic. And these are all rentals. I mean, they all say, you know, rent me on the side. I think those should absolutely be prohibited. It's just an accident waiting to happen. As far as the electrical scooters, I own two electrical scooters. Okay, I love them. When I go to Brickell or across the bridge, the ones that you rent on an app on your phone, unfortunately, I see them just strewn across the floor. And it really destroys this. It just destroys the city. As far as the walkway is concerned, I mean, you have, you know, elderly people on wheelchairs trying to get by, and then they're just on the floor. I don't think it's a good idea to bring those to Miami Beach. You're just going to have more of a... Everyone who's just riding the scooters are just going to get on the e-bikes, and they're going to be drinking, they're going to be doing drugs, and they're going to be... Instead of weaving in and out of traffic, they're going to be weaving in and out of sidewalks. So, you know, if you have a personal scooter to own, you're going to be more responsible. However, when you have a scooter that you rent, it's just on a minute basis. And I think, you know, the general consensus is they don't really care what happens to the scooter after that or where they leave it. So those are my comments. Thanks.
If I could, Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your comment. And I share your opinion that the ones that are thrown on the sidewalk and the street are a public safety issue for people tripping over. And I'm never going to support a program like that in the city of Miami Beach. So what I hope to bring forward for consideration at the commission level is a program that would either have their e-bikes that either have docking stations or would be required to be in a confined area inside a parking garage that would have a corral that the vendor would rent. But I agree. I spent a lot of time in Tallahassee as my former position, and now I see the streets there littered with these little scooters just thrown on the grass. And so I think it's a horrible program, and I will never support it here in Miami Beach. So I just wanted to give you some comfort that the direction I'm going in. Thank
you. Okay. Thank you for that, Commissioner Richardson. Seeing no other hands at this moment, we are now concluding item 11 as agreed. Just so everyone knows where we're going, we had requests for the administration. We're going to quickly take items 4 and 5. I think they will go relatively quickly. I then see a couple folks who I'm guessing may be here to talk about item 9. So that is going to be one we're going to take up. And then I see some folks here who might even be here for item 10, so we'll take that in turn. So with that, let's call up item 4 and
Number 11, I believe that the recommendation was to continue the item to your next meeting so that you guys could bring back the information, correct?
I think, Tom, I think maybe we should leave it open-ended until we're able to get a proposal from a consultant that we like and then bring it back as soon as we have.
Okay, so it's continued until such time as the city attorney is ready to bring it back.
Yeah.
But you want to bring it back to land use, correct?
That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
I just wanted to make sure the record reflected that, yep. That it will be coming back to you.
Yeah, I'd like to keep it in land use, and it may take a little bit of time to identify the consultant and get that work done.
Okay.
So that's what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman.
Good.
Thank you.
As agreed, okay? Everyone good? Okay. So let's take item 4, and again, we'll take 4, then 5. We're going to move fairly quickly. I'll just tee up number 4. It's a verbal update. There are many benefits where appropriate for pervious permeable pavement. In conversations and past discussions, we've talked about Ocean Drive. We've talked about the First Street Project. In private briefings, I've heard about parking lots that might be amenable. And really, we're looking for just a quick update and then maybe when this might come back to us. I don't believe there's formal action required today. So, Joe and David, you're recognized.
Okay. I'll start. Regarding the permeable pavements, one of the things that we've tasked our consultant, Jacobs, is, for example, in the parking area, the southwest corner where our electrical equipment is going to go for the pump station. We're going to look at that as an opportunity to look at some permeable pavements there. As I've explained before, permeable pavements really aren't suited for streets because of the maintenance that's required, the constant cleaning and flushing. If not, the permeable pavement does not really operate as it should. But we're looking at opportunities like that in parking areas and all that to be able to achieve some of the benefits of that. David?
Yes, Commissioner, and I know we had discussed possibilities of some of our forthcoming projects where that may be incorporated, such as Ocean Drive, as well as you had mentioned Lincoln Road potentially. So obviously with Ocean Drive, it's a little bit premature yet with the process that we're following with the whole Suskovich plan and that whole, but we'll have to keep that in mind. Lincoln Road, I know that we have a discussion on Friday that Commissioner Arriola asked to talk about that. Obviously, at the end of the day, we have to look at costs and we have to look at where, as Joe mentioned, where does it make sense and that sort of thing. But we understand that that's an important element that makes sense to incorporate when it does make sense. So we'll be looking at those projects.
That's great, and that's consistent with my expectation. I think there was one parking lot maybe in the 40s that had come up by conversation as a part. Could you just address that?
For the record, I know we've discussed it. Since I've been with the city, we've done a few parking lots or renovated some parking lots, and most of the modern ones in the last few years, we've always incorporated permeable pavement on the parking stalls, not in the drive lanes that Joe stated, because that's where you get most of the debris and oil and what have you. We're including also as part of Bayshore Park, the parking lot is going to have, I want to say it's even more than just pervious pavement. I believe it's going to have paver bricks that are pervious also in parking stalls and the such. So we do try to bring them in. And also a lot of the pathways that we're using in some of these parks are also permeable to some respect, depending on the materials that we use. So we do keep that in mind as often as we can.
Okay. So that's great. Looks like we're addressing it. Sounds like we have some things a little further out, like Ocean Drive. Sounds like we have some things real close in, anything related to the First Street project. So I think what I would like to see is this brought back just by way of a verbal update. Okay. When there's when there's new news to share, I guess is what I'd say. Tom, I don't know if you want to go out a meeting or two.
Do you want to say 6 months?
That would be good.
Is that good?
I think 6 months.
Sure.
Okay, let's do that then.
Okay.
Okay, so that's perfect. Item 4. Joe, if you'll stick with us, because I know we want to be sensitive. You had another commitment. I appreciate you hanging in. Item number 5, I really placed as a checking in. Clean and safe is the mantra. Garbage cans are part of it. I also requested that this be reviewed by the Resident Sustainability Committee and to see if there's any needs, opportunities to enhance cleanliness. Joe, please.
Yes, sir. And obviously, if there are any recommendations of specific areas that we need to look at, we'd be happy to do so. Again, as we've reported, we feel that the number of trash receptacles throughout the city in the strategic areas that they're placed are in line with our cleanliness program. We do have a high level of maintenance service. And we've amped up also, for example, for the entertainment district, where, as you know, we've added additional crews on the weekends to be able to accomplish that. And as you, Commissioner, you were out there on our tour last Friday evening, you saw that the crews were out there and the trash receptacles were in great shape. So we feel confident. We've looked at locations, but if there are specific recommendations where we would want to take a look at, we'd be happy to do so.
Okay. So, colleagues, this was placed as a discussion item. I sense from the administration that they will be looking on an ongoing basis as part of their normal course. There's not a financial request. I don't think there's a request to this body. Do either of you or the public, Nick, have any comments about the amount and placement of garbage cans as it relates to our goals for cleanliness?
I have one hand up on Zoom, Dave Dobler.
Okay, let's hear from Dave.
Hi, thank you for allowing me the opportunity. A couple of years ago, two comments. One is, a couple of years ago, we identified that there was a change in the Sunset Harbor area from a lot of warehouses to now a very residential and foot traffic area. What we realized is that we just hadn't revisited the layout upon the evolution of the neighborhood. And so just in general, I would say that we should probably just reevaluate the mapping of where we place garbage cans every couple of years, just to review whether the placements still make sense. So as neighborhoods transition from one use to another or growth, really that's We should just be reviewing our current models. And we've got a lot more garbage cans that have been placed out, and I think in really good locations. The other thing that I want to comment on is the very specific pole-mounted, the success of the cigarette pole-mounted receptacles that were sponsored by Commissioner Arriola years ago, and that Surf Rider has been maintaining over the past couple of years. They have collected hundreds of thousands of cigarette butts that are no longer in the streets or littered down the storm drain system. So I would consider a revisit of that program to identify whether we should expand the cigarette butt ash cans that are currently, we have 100 placed around the city, and they work exceptionally well. So that might be an area to revisit. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, David. Sarah?
Hi there. I am actually, I didn't expect a comment on this, but I'm on the Women's Council for the City of Miami Beach. And we, in our last meeting, had a discussion about doggy waste. And one of the things that we thought we would like to suggest to land use is that we put up more receptacles for doggy waste throughout the residential neighborhoods, just on poles, even on lighting fixtures or whatever, so that people aren't tossing waste in a bag into neighbors' yards or just leaving it. I mean, if there's a place to throw it away instead of in other neighbors' trash cans, that would be great. So maybe every two blocks, we could have a doggy waste can for people to pick up. I live in Mid-Beach. It'd be great there, but I'm sure it'd be great throughout the entire city of Miami Beach. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Colleagues, I think we've had a productive discussion. Commissioner Gongora, did you want to weigh in?
Sure. And I think this is a policy consideration that will keep coming back. It's been around again for many years. I think we've been discussing this issue since 2006. And we always place enough that we feel that we can possibly manage and handle. One of the ideas about adding more receptacles and on Miami Beach has always been a question of finances, and there's always been a group that's wanted to advertising to be able to pay for the cans, but then that goes against the city of Miami Beach position against putting a lot of commercial advertising out there. But since this commission has gone more into advertising than commissions in the past, that may be something you might want to look at again in the future.
Very good. Thank you for that comment. So I believe at this point, Joe, you've got some good feedback about the cigarette holders,
yes, sir.
The opportunity to address our canine friends and help there. I don't sense you need anything from us at this point. And if there is a need for policy direction or funding, you would come back.
Yes, sir.
And I think with that, probably the right direction, Tom, would probably be at this point to conclude the item.
Correct.
Does that make sense?
I'm fine with that.
Okay. So that is what we'll do. And Joe, we'll get you off to your other commitments. Thanks for hanging with us. Let's take up item number 9. And we're going to go 9, then 10. So if we could take up item 9, apartment hotels, particularly in the south of Fifth Area. Let me tee this up a little bit here. We all know that we've had discussions about apartment hotels in a particular area that has been front and center. We took action as a body and addressed prohibiting new locations. That was one action we took. We then had a spirited discussion about the city manager and the inspector general going down a path to understand the permitting process that had gone through, and that's its separate course. Those are interesting background. That's not what we're doing today. What we're doing today is really talking about two buckets of opportunities. One is, are there potential incentives, example, height or FAR, that we should be thinking about in the context of existing apartment hotels, i.e., are there incentives that would motivate someone to transition their use? So that's sort of bucket number one. Bucket number two is, given that we do have existing apartment hotels, are there opportunities to enhance quality of life by the way we're addressing the services? So, colleagues, those are the two broad buckets. If we can keep them separate, I think it would be helpful. So, Tom, can you kick off the conversation on bucket number one about incentives, FAR, height? Can you speak to that?
Sure. As we've indicated, and we have a map attached to this particular memo that outlines the two specific areas, but the areas that are zoned RPS and RPS 1 and RPS 2 are predominantly residential in character. And there are a number of existing apartment hotels within that area. So one of the things that we wanted to look at was, are there any incentives that could perhaps compel the owners of apartment hotels that are existing to convert back to a residential apartment? And two of the biggest incentives that we've seen in the past have been height and FAR. Just to give you some perspective, within the RPS 1 and RPS 2 districts, the maximum building height is 45 feet, unless your lot is 50 feet in width or less, which a lot of these lots are. In that particular instance, the maximum building height is 40 feet. Now, that particular height is consistent with the maximum FARs for both of those districts, which are 1.25 for RPS 1 and 1.5 for RPS 2. If you were to study potentially a very modest increase in FAR limited to those two areas, it's not an increase that would be citywide. It would be very strategic and it would be very limited. However, any FAR increase within that area, while it likely would be a good incentive for people to think about converting from apartment hotel to permanent residential, it would require voter approval. Now, we have seen in the past where the voters have approved FAR questions for very types of surgical FAR increases. Last year, the voters approved 3 FAR increases for what were very limited changes to the ordinance. I don't think it's out of the question that it could be considered by the voters. Conversely, if you were going to have an increase in FAR, and even without an increase in FAR, an increase in height could also be an incentive, certainly as part of an increase in FAR, but even on its own, due to the fact that even within the allowable FARs in place now, a height increase would allow for more volumetric space and the more creative distribution of allowable FAR and volume within a site. Any height increase, which we also anticipate would be modest, we're not suggesting that high-rises be permitted within these two zoning districts, that's legislative. That is not something that would require voter approval.
Thank you, Tom. So just to see if I'm tracking, I'm sure my colleagues are tracking. So two buckets, FAR and height. FAR needs voter approval. Clearly would want to hear from our community before we proceed there. Height is legislative. And without getting into the specifics, it looks like current heights are somewhere between 40 and 45 feet.
Correct.
You said modest. Modest is usually good. And the notion would be, is there an incremental modest height that potentially would incent new uses? In other words, the height would be for a residential use, not a transit. Let me ask one question, and then I'm going to recognize David. Just at this point on the FAR height angle, have we heard from residents, the property owners, have we had any outside feedback on this concept at this moment?
We haven't done a deep dive into this simply because we wanted to first get policy direction. In my experience, property owners certainly are usually favorably disposed to an FAR increase because they would get more value within their property, but we haven't done any formal outreach.
Okay. Colleagues, I'd like to hear from David, and then we'll bring it up here on the height FAR side first.
On the height FAR.
Yeah, and FAR.
I just want to make sure, what are we incentivizing here? We're just incentivizing the existing apartment hotels to convert back to apartments?
No. We're talking about specific geography. Tom, please add it to it. We're talking about specific geography. And if there were different uses for those, if we thought there were different uses that would have less impact on the neighborhood, if someone migrated to a different use, they would avail themselves of the height. Tom, do you want to add edit to that?
It's my understanding that you've already prohibited the change of use to apartment hotels.
David's correct. What this would do, because apartment hotels are now prohibited in both of these districts, so you can't do any new apartment hotels. So if you have an existing apartment hotel, the theory behind this proposal is that if you're willing to convert to fully residential apartment, basically abandon your apartment hotel use and convert to residential apartment only, then you would get a slightly higher FAR and potentially a slightly higher building height.
So this would only apply to an existing apartment hotel in the RPS 1 or RPS 2?
It would apply to any property within that area, but it would only apply to residential apartments. So if you have an apartment hotel right now, you have no ability to expand that. You have no ability to add on to it. So if you're at or below the maximum FAR currently, you have no feasible way of expanding your property. However, if you are willing to abandon the apartment hotel and convert to residential apartment, you could potentially avail yourself of a higher height and a higher FAR if that was approved. But it would apply to all properties in the area, regardless of whether you're currently a residential apartment or you're currently an apartment hotel.
So this would also apply to an apartment,
yes.
Just a regular apartment
Correct.
Building.
Yeah, that was... You got straight to the point that concerns me about this item, because the intended expressed reason behind it, to incentivize current apartment hotels to go up in height or have more FAR, sounds good. But the way that it's written, and Tom has just stated that that's what it would do, would allow all the properties to have increased height and increased FAR if the FAR is approved by the voters. So I think this one requires a lot more thought and study. You know, my questions whenever I see an upzoning item is how many potential properties can be impacted. I want to know the number. Mm-hmm. I want to see the map. I want to look at what we're doing for the entire neighborhood. So this one concerns me. I won't be here, but I would encourage those of you that are to look at this very very carefully because we have a couple of apart hotels. I don't think you want to use that as an excuse to upzone the entire district.
Correct. I mean, this, on the face of it, it's a great idea for the existing apartment hotels. I think there's just a very few limited ones. But to blanketly tell every apartment building in the area that you can now add an extra floor or two or three, what's going to happen is these owners are just going to put up their buildings for sale and developers are going to come in and it's going to completely reshape the neighborhood. So, I think the creativity on this idea is great, but there definitely needs to be notice and public outreach. Mm-hmm. And you know, we need to explore it further.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
If you wanted to, because this is just, we're at the discussion phase.
Sure.
This is a concept. We never thought about whether or not we could apply this incentive solely to those properties that are currently licensed as apartment hotels only. That's something we could explore to see, one, whether or not we could do that legally, and if we can, if that might be a better policy option to incentivize those who are legally established as an apartment hotel to incentivize their conversion.
Yeah, I think so, Tom. That's what I'm sensing from my colleague, and that's what I'm seeing in those comments. And so exactly what you said, you know, that use, or potentially a much more narrow geographic scope, right? We're really not looking to change the height more broadly. It's right. Really more tailored approach. So that would also be my direction. So we're still on the height FAR. David, other comments?
No, nope. That's it.
Daniel, come on up on that element.
Thank you very much, Daniel Seraldo with Miami Design Preservation League. I think a lot of what the commissioners have said, including Commissioner Gangora, is a very good point that we need a map of which properties are impacted. I see there is a map, but it's just a map of the whole area. And are we sort of causing a bigger issue by increasing height and density in what is really one of our most beautiful historic districts down in south of Fifth? So if it is going to continue, I think, and I thought there was a commission resolution years ago, Tom, that any height increases should have massing diagrams, et cetera. I think this commission implemented that. So hopefully in the future there's a little more thought put into these items so that there is that full community input. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that. So I want to segue to the second bucket of the quality of life. But I think on that one, Tom, you know, I think David's comment about, you know, engaging the community, clearly there's some stakeholders, you know, people who have properties that are relevant, and then the more targeted approach, I think that's worth continuing that. Is there anything else you need on that bucket, or does that get us going?
No, that definitely gets us going, particularly if we're going to bring this back to land use.
Yes.
We can take a look at a more strategic, surgical approach, tailored approach that's specific to those uses and showing where those existing uses are on a map, because perhaps we could create a more narrow geographic area.
Okay, that's great. So now the second bucket is quality of life related. I'm using the broad topic to include traffic, enforcement. Tom, could you introduce some of the ideas that the administration thinks are worthy of consideration, given that we have them today? How do we sort of best manage the situation?
Sure. We've identified three sub-areas that are in the memo, and I'll briefly describe all three. The first is a comprehensive strategy to address quality of life issues. A lot of the concerns with regard to transient uses within the larger South Beach area, and this applies to not just apartment hotels, but the short-term rental of apartments, as well as hotels and suite hotel uses, is the behavior of people and the impacts that transient guests have on an area. And so our thought was that we begin to coordinate with the applicable departments that are sort of on the front lines of that, and that would be the police department, the code compliance department, and the parking department, and that we discuss in concert with the residents not just what the biggest issues are, but how we could best go about addressing those issues. What would be some sort of out-of-the-box thinking and out-of-the-box strategies to address those quality of life and behavior issues? The next issue is traffic and circulation management, and as the commission is aware, on September 17th, the Transportation Department was directed to begin to prepare traffic calming measures and a traffic calming plan for the south of Fifth Area. I did speak to the transportation director, who said he will be reaching out to the south of Fifth residents. This, he anticipates, is about a 6 to 9 month process because of the fact that they have to do data accumulation, and more importantly, they are required to get approval from the county for any types of physical modifications that are made to the streets. And so it is an ongoing process that they're trying to expedite as quickly as they can, but in order to get county approval, the data gathering is a very important component of this. And then lastly, we had suggested exploring a zoning overlay for 4th Street. Currently, the north side of 4th Street is zoned CPS2, which is commercial medium intensity. And while uses such as entertainment are prohibited, and there is a 2 a.m. cutoff time for alcohol, you still could potentially get more intense uses between 4th and 5th Street because of the CPS2 zoning. We currently are working on an overlay for the south side of 6th Street in order to transition to the Flamingo Park RM1 area to the north. And our thought was a similar overlay could be developed for the north side of 4th Street so that the uses that are allowed will be limited in impact or have their impact reduced, particularly in close proximity to lower scale multifamily residential properties. And so on this particular item, if this is something that the Land Use Committee is favorably disposed to exploring, we can also come back with a draft for this in the coming months.
Okay, Tom, thank you for that. So quality of life, traffic and circulation, and zoning are sort of the three broad areas. We have someone for the public. If we could hear from David, if you could comment.
Sure. As far as quality of life, I'm a big advocate against apartment hotels. And one of the things, I know you mentioned one of the things that you're incentivizing apartment hotels to go back to apartment buildings. We might throw a carrot in the stick and they may take or they may not. But one thing you guys could probably do is enforce the resident manager provision for apartment hotels. As it is written, there should be in an apartment hotel, there is supposed to be one unit that is specifically for a resident supervisor. And that's not the case now. So if you go to Casa Sophie or any of these apartment hotels, you'll see that this room is not there for a resident supervisor. As it is written, and if anyone can read, it basically, the meaning is that someone who lives on the property and can make sure that it's not getting out of control. And unfortunately, that's the case at Casa Sophie. And believe it or not, when it first opened up, there was a unit there for a resident supervisor. But since there was no enforcement, they basically put a wall between the unit and they made it into two units. And there is no on-site resident supervisor. As far as traffic, I wrote a little thing here. Every single night and more on the weekends, at least dozens of cars race through stop signs in my neighborhood. Okay, and I personally see it. I walk my dog at night, and it's unbelievable. There is no stop sign, it's just a matter of time before someone actually gets hurt. And if I can just have 2 more minutes, that'd be great.
Yes, 2 more minutes.
If you were to, on a Friday, Saturday night, stand on 3rd Street and Meridian, you would see at least every 30 seconds a stop sign getting run. And between 4th and 5th, at least every other minute, there is someone either drag racing on our street or just blatantly, recklessly driving from each stop sign to the next. I understand that we wanted to wait 6 to 9 months for a report for this. Just for a report. I don't think we have that luxury of waiting anymore, unfortunately. if this 2 a.m. ban happens, I believe Club Story is one of the ones that are grandfathered in. And what's probably going to happen is everyone is going to be going to that establishment after 2. And unfortunately, Meridian and Jefferson is going to be one of these side roads that people often take to get to Club Story. So if you really wanted to stop speeding and reckless driving in our neighborhoods, it's a simple solution. Put some speed bumps. You know, it could be temporary. You can see how it affects the neighborhood. But if you really wanted to, that would pretty much eliminate all the drag racing, all the speeding in our neighborhood. One of the last things also that's a quality of life issue that you guys may not be aware of is that a lot of the restaurant owners in South of Fifth, the valet clerks actually have their own handicap signs, play cards, and they go out. And whenever someone comes in to go to a restaurant, when they valet the car, they actually park it on a residential spot. And they use, the valet people actually use their handicap stickers, put it on the card, on the rearview mirror, and then literally park the car in our residential neighborhood. I have videos of this. I have pictures of this. You're more than welcome to come check it out if you want. If you go down Meridian between 1st and 2nd Street, almost every single car is a handicap car, or it has a handicap sticker. And, you know, that's taking away spaces from us and actual people who need to park. So I think as far as quality of life, those are things that you can actually do right now instead of having to wait 9 months for a report.
Thank you for that, David. And we're going to pick up on it. We're going to see if there are other folks for the public. But just so at least up here in the dais. So under quality of life, we'll come back to the resident manager concept. We'll come back to handicap placards as well as all the other ideas. And then under the circulation traffic, we'll talk about are there opportunities to accelerate, e.g. speed bumps, status of hiring someone. So there's some meat, but I want to keep it open to the public if I could.
I think I've been serving with you for a while. I have the exact same 3 points.
Okay,
I'm becoming a three-point person.
Okay, I don't know who's copying who, but we're still in the work. Do we have anyone on Zoom or anyone else in the public that wants to be recognized?
Mr. Chairman, there's no one on Zoom with a hand up.
Okay, so let's keep going. Commissioner Gorongora, you could walk through it. Then you've got the same points if you want to.
No, actually, I wrote the exact same three points that you articulated. It's kind of funny.
Fair enough. We're all doing the same thing. So can we get clarity? What is the current rules related to the resident manager?
Sure, I can address that. Under the code, at least one apartment hotels require at least one residential apartment. And they also require a resident supervisor. So if they only have one apartment unit, that apartment unit has to be for the resident supervisor. One of the things that we've done this year, and we've asked the customer service department, and they've done this for the renewals of all BTRs for apartment hotels, is to put in express language requiring that the name and the contact information of that resident supervisor be provided. We're also requiring that on all new CUs. Now, in terms of enforcing that, that's one of the things that we want to meet with police, code, and parking about. That's one of the things that we need to strategize with code enforcement about in terms of the enforcement of that. Because even though they might give us that information and say, so-and-so is the resident supervisor, here's the contact information, if they're not living there, if they can't be contacted, then that could potentially result in a violation. So the enforcement of that is something that we would be working on.
Okay, and that's part of the quality of life
correct
plan, so it looks like we have a thought there. The handicap placards that were brought up, who can address that? Tom, I know this is not all your world, but
either a combination of police and parking, and that's something where I'd want to meet with the chief or his designee and Monica Beltran to discuss how best to enforce that. Mm-hmm. That's something that should be able to be enforced. Mm-hmm. The best strategy for that, I would need to talk to them to see what the best strategy for enforcing that would be.
Okay. On the quality of life buckets, including the resident manager, the handicap placards, and the other things you want to do, Tom, what do you need us to do today? I mean, the answer is we want to see it, want more faster. What would you like us to do?
I think that you could definitely keep this item pending before the committee, so I would suggest continuing it to your next meeting for an update, and then give us direction to meet with those applicable departments to address not just these issues identified, but also other potential quality of life issues. And we could also include outreach to the affected stakeholders in the south of Fifth area to continue to get their perspective on that.
Yep, that all sounds good, and that'll be part of the motion. Now let's talk about circulation in the traffic study. Have we hired a consultant to undertake that work?
I believe that the transportation department is in the process of doing that, of retaining the consultant to do the data gathering. And I think what Jose is talking about in the long term are the physical improvements that do take time. With regard to the short-term installation of temporary speed bumps, I believe something like that can be done more quickly. I would need to talk to Jose about that to see what would need to be done. But if that's something that this committee recommends, I can certainly reach out to the transportation director to see if there's any way that temporary speed bumps could be installed in order to address public safety issues.
And if I could, and Commissioner Gongora, feel free to weigh in. I think what I would like to see is that we are exploring the temporary, always in close consultation with the residents and the stakeholders. You know, some people love them, some people don't. So, you know, we have to balance that. And then we would like to accelerate the progress of the study that is undertaken. You know, 6 to 9 months, given the urgency, seems like a way. So that's sort of bucket two. And on the zoning, Tom, the CPS two, for 4th Street, what would be a potential next step for that?
I think the best thing to do with that would be to also continue that to your next meeting with direction for staff to begin to prepare a 4th Street overlay in terms of the actual outline or framework for a code amendment for that.
Great. So 4th Street overlay, exploration of the temporary quick hits, acceleration of the study, quality of life as described, including the enforcement mechanisms, resident manager, handicap placards, all done in close consultation with the residents and the stakeholders, and keeping it at committee. That's a straw man, Commissioner Gongora.
You did a great job of recapping everything and all the points. Just to add a little bit more, because I agree with everything you said, 6 to 9 months is a really long time for a traffic study. In the past, we used to be able to do them in 3 to 4. So I definitely think that can be accelerated. And I agree with you, the speed bumps can be done quicker, at least temporary ones, but you've got to have a meeting with SOFNA, because if not, they're going to potentially come back and raise hell. So we definitely have to do that before that portion moves forward.
David? Just to follow up about Please. The resident manager, and if I can speak to Tom on this. So what is the definition of a resident supervisor? Does he have to live on premises?
Yes, the resident supervisor, it doesn't say it in the code, but that's pretty much what a resident supervisor is. And so they're supposed to be living in one of the apartment units, and if it's only one apartment unit, they're supposed to be living in that apartment unit.
Okay, and because right now at Casa Sophie, there is no live-in resident supervisor. Is that a code enforcement, or is that a who actually enforces that?
That would be a code compliance violation. And so that's one of the things that we need to look at, not just at Casa Sophie, but any other apartment hotel, whether or not their resident supervisor is living on site.
And if we can enforce that, because we've called code that there is no enforcement, and then you know what they say? Talk to planning. So it seems like it's a runaround every time when we have a problem, and no one wants to take some responsibility from the city on that. So if we can actually get someone in there, specifically Casa Sophie, and I know there's another one on 4th and Meridian where someone has to live on there. That would overnight.
Perhaps we can just amend our motion from this committee to also proactively instruct administration to go out and enforce that code provision against all existing apart hotels.
I would agree with that. So I think that's a good add. So thank you for that. Monica, we are talking about enforcement of handicap placards. We've already got a motion. Tom's going to get with you. If you have a quick solution for us where you think you can make headway, that's what we really want to hear. If you got that, we're ready for you. If not, we'll take it offline. But go ahead.
And Monica, I ran over when I heard that Monica Belchin, director of parking department.
Monica, did you hear what the issue was?
Yes, the abuse of disabled placards.
Okay.
Yeah, I was listening. That's why I ran over. Just to say that this is actually a national problem. And it's a very thin line between violating the rights of the disabled and enforcing this regulation. So I will work with our ADA coordinator for the city. It would be ideal, and I don't know that we could do this, if we could have, for example, the residents that have disabled placards to register them with us, maybe, so that we can have an indication of how many people in the neighborhood have these placards, because there's a possibility that there indeed are many people that have these, right? Other than that, enforcement is difficult, but I don't like to think that anything is impossible. So I will talk to Valeria and see if we can move forward. Ideally, we would do something like noticing somebody that they need to prove ownership or something like that, but I need to make sure that that is doable.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question then, David. You're recognized. What are existing, and this might be for Nick, the city attorney, so what are the penalties in place if a valet operator who is not ADA, does not have ADA requirements, if they start using those, what penalties are in place for someone doing that?
We do have a valet ordinance, and the penalties are $1,000 and up. And if we found an employee to do that, I believe we could hold the company responsible for the actions of their employees. Nick, you tell me if it's otherwise.
That's right, Monica. So it's separate from the question of, is a handicap permit being used improperly? There's also the question of, is somebody operating a valet operation in a space that's not designated or permitted for valet, and that would be a violation of the valet ordinance.
Correct. I just got a text as well from somebody from the Transportation, Parking, Bicycle, Pedestrian Committee, saying that they wanted to put that also on our committee agenda.
Okay, David, did you have a thought?
Hi.
Time and any night, and it's happening all the time. I mean, they don't try to hide it either. They wear their valet attire, and they park it right in residential. If you wanted to come with a code enforcement, we can sit outside, and it happens every 15 minutes.
I'm going to give you my cell number.
Sure.
305.
Let's do that.
Give it to everybody. 305.
Go ahead. You can take that. Okay. Let's keep it going.
But yeah, you can you call guys take at any time, and I'll send an officer, right, and we will send there and make sure that we address it. Absolutely.
That sounds like a great progress. And as you have those conversations, if we think we need stiffer penalties, if that's another part of the stick, I would add that to the motion, which continues to go. But let's hear another voice. Sarah.
Well, I'm disabled, and I have a placard. So just to let you know that the state of Florida insists that the placard has an ID number on it, and it correlates with the name of the person that's disabled. So if, you know, I own two cars, they're both registered in my name, it would be really easy to find out whether a placard hanging in one of my cars is actually because I'm disabled or because I borrowed it from somebody.
It's difficult because I would have to be able to speak to you and you would have to show me your ID so that I can do the comparison. So if you park and you're at home, I wouldn't know where to go verify it. That's the problem.
Can't you find that the number, the ID number on the placard would correlate with the, you know, the car that's... If we can register the cars to
the person. It's not the car.
It's your driver's license or your driving permit or your state ID.
Right.
That's what's on the placard, and I don't have access to that information.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Gungor?
It is challenging and upsetting. We've discussed this at Neighborhoods Committee in the past because it's just not valets. We see a number of fraudulent uses of handicap parking passes, and it's terrible because obviously the people that need them should have them and should have access to that parking, but we see it all the time. You're going to Whole Foods or the gym or Lincoln Road, and you see somebody like sweaty in their gym clothes that's just come from working out bounce out of their vehicle with the handicap placard. So we need to figure out whatever we can do to, as aggressively as we legally can, pursue and go after this.
Yeah, and I'd like to highlight something, and that is that some people don't realize if you are driving somebody who has an ADA placard and you drop them off in front of the business, you're not entitled to use that card, that placard. The placard is for the shortest distance for accessibility to a building. So once you've dropped somebody off, you no longer have the right to use that. And that's something that some people do not realize.
Okay. Anyone else from the public?
Thank you.
Tom, this has been a productive discussion, a lot of different elements. Do you want to recap, or do you feel like you've got the direction you need?
No, I think I've got it. I think that when we come back in either December or January, whenever the next meeting is, we'll have more information, and we'll begin to coordinate with all of the departments as well as the affected people from South of Fifth. I will talk to Jose about the temporary speed bumps, but I think Commissioner Gungor is correct. We probably would have to do some minimal outreach to get some consensus before, and I think that the county also has to approve even temporary speed bumps. So we'll try, but to a certain extent, our hands are tied by the county because the county does have to approve any modification that the city makes to roadways.
Okay, all good. We'll hear it at the next time this body meets, and I appreciate that you acknowledge working closely with the stakeholders in SOFNA, and I would just sort of underline with urgency given the situation we have. Okay, with that, we're going to move to item number 10. Some folks have been here. I think have been quite patient. Commissioner Gongora, this is your item, if you would like to introduce it.
Sure. I'll go ahead and do so. This item was a referral, which proved to be a little problematic at the last meeting. As we all know, we see a lot of homes being demolished with new modern homes going up in their place. You can see it through various corridors in our city, from the Islands to the Venetian to North Bay Road. It seems to be happening more and more. And there's a concern that was recently, you know, in the news with regard to the beautiful home on North Bay Road, which is the former Phil Collins and Jennifer Lopez home. And I understand a wonderful billionaire who has a fantastic success story, and I enjoy following him in Forbes magazine. But I'm not so happy with the idea of beautiful historic homes being demolished. This was referred with a caveat that we're not here to discuss involuntary designations today, so that's not part of the item that was referred. And because of that, I think the administration feels that what they could recommend is somewhat limited. I did want to recap what I now understand to be the history behind some of these homes. Obviously, if a home is designated historic or in a historic district, it goes before the HPB, and there's another set of criteria. But a lot of these older homes, and I think pre-1942 homes, aren't necessarily historic, so they go before the Design Review Board. And even though the Design Review Board is able to consider things such as adaptation and structural conditions and other arenas in their decision making, they have felt somewhat limited, because I've seen it at some of their meetings, on what they can do. When I was on the commission previously, the policy in place for quite some time throughout the end of my tenure was there actually were some disincentives for people that purchased these pre-1942 homes from demolishing them and building a new home. The Design Review Board could waive that, but they were there. For whatever reason, after the changing of the guard, as always happens, from 2013 to 2014, one of the things that the 2014 Commission did right away in their first year is remove those disincentives. And I really feel that for the past 7 years, there's just been a lot more destruction of homes than we ever saw in the past. I have, you know, I see both sides of this issue because I respect the real estate community. I respect people being able to invest in a home and make decisions in their home and maximize their investment in their home. But I think when you buy in a city such as Miami Beach with so much history, a city that we state that we are committed to preservation of our history and our homes, I just feel that there's something more that we can do. I'd like to hear from the public. I would like for Tom to be able to give us a recap of those disincentives that used to be in place that were taken out in 2014. Maybe that would be one area to look into. And finally, this, as you stated at the beginning, Mr. Chair, this is my last meeting of the Land Use and Sustainability Committee. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts because somebody will have to pick this up if it's going to move forward from here.
Very, very good. And I will take the last part. I will pick this up because this is an important conversation. I actually have a thought on process, which I will tee up. But first, let's hear from the public.
Thank you very much. My name is Daniel Seraldo. Can I have like 4 minutes?
Yes.
Just want to make sure I get everything in the record. And thank you, Commissioner Gongora, for your bravery in tackling this very important issue. I remember about 10 years ago, I was here at the commission when this item had come up in another form, and it went to land use. And at that time, it was very, you know, it was out in the community, and we've heard from all sides. You know, I think those sides we know we'll probably hear today on Zoom, different sides too. But I think what we really need to remember are a couple of things. First, the Historic Preservation Board really already does have the authority and, in fact, the duty to review and recommend structures for historic designation. So you're right, that issue of involuntary designation, that's actually not even at this committee, it's not even part of this discussion. It is law that owner consent is not a requirement, so we'll move on from that. And I'm sorry that you all had some people calling at that last meeting. It seemed like it was like coordinated by a certain side to throw that out there, and it's sort of a red herring that there isn't a lot of education about. Hopefully we can do better educating the public about that issue. However, this committee can help by addressing some of the imbalances that Commissioner mentioned that really currently incentivizes the process of demolition, total demolition of our architecturally significant single-family homes. Can you imagine the Al Capone house, the Carl Fisher house, the Phil Collins house, all of these homes just filing a form, submitting an application, going to DRB, and DRB saying, there's nothing we could do. Miami Beach is a really A-class, world-class city, just like Palm Beach and Coral Gables, and we really should have a little more protection. I know Tom lives in Coral Gables. I always joke with Tom, all we want is the zoning that you have. So we'll keep pushing for that, and I know he's under a lot of pressure as well from the development community, and we understand the stress related to that. We know that we have an issue. We know the residents are not happy. And there have been negative impacts that, as Commissioner said, 10 years ago, we wanted to do things like reduce speculation, reduce the environmental impact of demolition. And we're told by the planning department that all of these new rules to reduce the disincentives would somehow magically lead to a reduction in all these things. Of course, we've seen the last 10 years nothing but speculation. And, you know, while we do have some new owners that are tearing down homes saying it's for their own use, what we often see is those people later do redevelop and sell. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that we have a lot of very wealthy individuals moving to Miami Beach, buying these beautiful properties and restoring them, and we don't give them enough credit. And we should be promoting that fact that you won't see it in the headlines, but there are many people coming in and buying beautiful homes on Sunset, on Venetians, keeping them and renovating them. So in wrapping up, we have, in the last several months at MDPL, we had a generous donor that allowed us to fund a legal fellow who has been studying the topic and also interacting with Coral Gables in Palm Beach and their planning departments, or someone from Palm Beach who used to be here as part of the DRB process. He's given us a lot of good insight into what they do there at one of our wealthiest communities in the state. And so what we would like to ask today are two things. One, can we have a joint meeting of the DRB-HPB to discuss some topics? The second is we would really like to look into the demolition impact fee, which we, in our initial talks with some of the developers who might be on the line, we see that there is a growing consensus that some sort of demo impact fee could help even fund resiliency and preservation. So we hope you will bring that forward and continue the discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that, Daniel. Nick, do we have folks online that want to participate?
Mr. Chairman, I see no hands up on Zoom.
Okay. I see someone in the room who's... Well, I see two people coming. So come on up.
Well, I just wanted to mention, when I first moved here, it was perhaps I would see a home getting demolished maybe once every couple of years, you know, driving through the city. And oftentimes they weren't terribly important homes. They weren't remarkable. Slowly but surely, it got to the point where we were seeing the absolute decimation of North Bay Road. All of the islands on the Venetian Causeway now are one fraction of what they used to be in terms of beauty. An awful lot of people are not thrilled about what this new construction is. These McMansions that we see, they really seem to be appealing to people that don't really live here in Miami Beach as much as people coming from abroad and investing money. But what's really shocking to me is on the last DRB agenda, there were 25 historic homes requesting demolition. 25 in 1 month. Now, it didn't happen. They weren't able to get to all of them. We went from maybe 25 in 25 years, you know, prior to when I moved here, to now 25 a month. And there's soon not going to be any left. So we really do need, I mean, our mechanism for protecting our history is broken right now. We have no protection. And it's Sutter's Mill right now. The people searching for gold are coming here, running here from every part of, you know, the world, investing in properties in my neighborhood, for maybe $1 million, and then turning around and building a McMansion and trying to sell it for anywhere from $10 to $15 million. Now, one of the things that I'm really finding is sad is that middle-class families who maybe could afford $1 million home can not afford a $15 million home. And it's forcing out the middle class and the upper middle class. The neighborhoods the neighborhood that I live in is very family-oriented and young families. And my next-door neighbor built a house that's identical to mine, and they renovated the house, and they made it beautiful, and they're thrilled to be in this house. We need to look into that. We need to make our city affordable. Because now every single house is on the chopping block in every single neighborhood in terms of demolition and rebuilding. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Burkow.
Thank you, Commissioners. Jeff Burkow, 590 Lakeview Drive in Miami Beach. I think the previous speakers have oversimplified the process and not really discussed the details involved. It's not as simple as filling out a piece of paper and going to DRB and getting DRB to approve a new home and allow the demolition of the older home. Our clients have put together tremendous architectural plans and have worked with staff and have designed beautiful residences that comply with all of the criteria for design review at substantial cost to them, both in terms of architects, landscape architects, and other consultants. I think the impact of sea level rise has only been discussed glancingly, and because most of these older homes were built several feet below what is current base flood level, and given the opportunity with freeboard to raise significantly above base flood elevation, we see that our clients are saying it's not safe to live in this old house. I've got to raise it.
If I raise it, I have to spend a significant amount of money to raise it and bring it up to code. For example, and this was cited at the Design Review Board meeting earlier this month, Orlando Bravo, our client who purchased 5800 North Bay Road, the quote-unquote Phil Collins house, he had submitted, if you'll give me a minute.
Yes, sir.
He had submitted estimates into the record that to bring that property up to code, it would have cost $42 million. And clearly, I think that's an unreasonable cost for a city to require a property owner to preserve an existing home that he doesn't want to live in. We have another client who spent $39 million on a waterfront property, and his estimates are that it would cost about $28 million to bring the property up to code. By the way, Orlando Bravo is not some speculator from Europe who's moving here. Orlando Bravo created or is the head of a very significant private equity technology firm. He is moving his entire family here from San Francisco. He is living here. He has two young daughters. He's moving his entire company here, the Thoma Bravo Company, and all of his 40 employees are being moved here. He's making a significant investment for his family and for the city, quite frankly. Regarding a demo impact fee, most of the developers that I know and the clients that we have would not object to a demolition impact fee, provided that the uses are appropriate.
Great. Thank Jeff, you. If I could.
Yes, sir.
Well, this is really a conversation. I'll recognize my colleague in a second. I don't anticipate that we as a body are prepared to take formal action, but we do have a thought, and in fact, Daniel had the same thought I had about the joint DRB-HPB meeting as a proper mechanism. And in addition to the demolition fee, obviously would love you to be part of the ongoing dialogue, but are there other enhancements that you think we as a body, that joint committee, should at least consider that you think are worthy of conversation?
I think the ones that Tom outlined in his memo are perfect. Those are worth considering. I'm just, you know, a little concerned about the HPB and the DRB getting together without proper guidance from the city and without the same guidance that involuntary designation is not an available alternative.
Okay, appreciate that. Commissioner Gongora, you wanted to be recognized?
Yeah. Hey, Jeff, they pulled out the big guns today. I hardly nobody
pulled out anything.
At least for you here, but nice seeing you at my last
Thank
meeting.
Thank you. Great to see you, and I wish you well in all your future endeavors, and you've been a great public servant.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But I also wanted to let you know, this isn't really about Mr. Bravo. That's just kind of the most visible house that highlighted this. I think he has a wonderful success story. Of course, we're excited if he's moving a business to our area. So this isn't about him, per se. This is more about a proliferation over many years. This just happened to be the story that captured the media's attention because of the famous past residents and current resident. To be. So we're looking for ways to kind of incentivize people to retain the historic look, to disincentivize future uses. I think your client's house is going before DRB tomorrow, so that it's not going to be impacted by anything that this committee does today. But we're
hopefully
looking,
not.
I don't think so. But we're looking for ways to stop this from continuing on in the future. Many of our residents are concerned about the changing look of our city. I'm not sure if you still have your house, but you have a beautiful house on Lakeview Drive, or you did for many years.
I still do. I intend to maintain it, and that's my personal choice. But I will tell you this. I've gotten ridiculous offers to sell the property, and quite frankly, they're very hard to ignore. I don't think I would get those same offers if it was very easy for the city to involuntarily designate my home.
Yeah, this item isn't about involuntary designation.
Thankfully. And I think it's not just me. You heard from Tom at the City Commission meeting that there are potentially thousands of people who, homeowners, who are in the same position that I am in. And for those homeowners, their home is their entire investment strategy, or at least a significant part of their investment strategy, and it is their it's their exit. It's their exit strategy, and it is their it's the foundation of their net worth. And they're very concerned that any attempts by the commission to legislate something that would be involuntary would negatively impact their properties. And I just want to say one other thing. Mr. Bravo, you know, people, you hear that people are complaining about the demolition of the older homes. Mr. Bravo reached out to all of the property owners within the mailed notice radius for his DRB application, and every single one of them either supported or decided not to object to his application. It's not misleading at all, Daniel. It is absolutely correct.
Okay. But I'm going to cut it because I don't want this to be about Mr. Bravo. This isn't his DRB hearing.
I'd like him not to make comments when he's not on the mic.
Right. Okay. Well, this isn't about – my whole point, because you brought it back to Mr. Bravo, is this isn't about Mr. Bravo. This is about what's been happening in our city over a period of time. And I agree with you, and I'm going to cut the conversation after this comment. Yes, a lot of people have their net worth involved in their home. We have a significant real estate community, and we're all mindful and thoughtful of that. But a lot of people buy in Miami Beach as well because we've had a commitment towards maintaining the historic look and feel of the city, the Art Deco look on Ocean Drive, a lot of the beautiful homes, and we're getting away from that. So the flip side of that is that if people are cashing out and leaving our community, what they're leaving behind, a lot of the people that are staying here didn't buy in wanting that. So that's our job always, is trying to balance these two things and come up with something reasonable that works. Okay. So thank you.
Gentlemen, we have a couple other callers. Yes. So thank you. Yep, and come on up. So first we're going to go to Zoom, and then you'll be recognized right after. So one caller from Zoom, one in the public, then we'll go back to Zoom.
Okay, perfect. Our first Zoom caller is Michael Larkin. Michael, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Gongora. I'm here in support of the additional development incentives. My address is 3538 Flamingo Drive. I own a 1924 Med Revival home, and when I think in the future of how I want to expand it, I certainly would welcome the opportunity to have additional lot coverage, height, unit area, and an expanded use of the rooftop. Tom was good enough to include lot coverage and height in his incentives, but I also think that could be expanded to unit area, which means building volume, and expanded use of the rooftop for amenities. With regard to disincentives, not surprisingly, I'm not in favor of almost any of them, but there is one that I've spoken about with Daniel that I am in favor of, and that's the creation of a fee for total demolition. I think that's entirely reasonable and something that should be explored by the City Commission. The one thing, though, that I'll tell you all is usually leads to the demolition of these architecturally significant homes are the floodplain regulations and the 50% rule. Within Chapter 54, there's a definition of substantial improvement, and it means over 1 year, if the value of improvements to the home exceeds 50% of the market value of the structure, then it loses its grandfather status and must be brought up to current floodplain regulations. Within the last few years, that definition was amended to exclude alterations to historic structures. I'm just wondering, I don't have the answer to this, it's not a rhetorical question, but I'm just wondering if the definition can be further amended to include architecturally significant homes. I have clients that are on Flamingo Drive, and they very much want to save their home, and I brought up to them the 50% rule that I just described to you. So what they're having to do in the course of the next 5 to 7 years is just do a little bit at a time over the course of 1 year, wait, do another set of improvements the following year. And, you know, most homeowners don't have the patience for that and given the current situation, would just demo the pre-42 home. So what I'm asking you to consider is a further amendment to the definition of substantial improvement in Chapter 54 to also include architecturally significant homes and not just historic structures. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Gongora.
Thank you, Mike. Jean Marie.
Hi, my name is Jean Marie Echemendia, and I think that we should have some kind of better system to designate homes historic. There used to be something, but it wasn't easy to use. I tried to designate one of my homes at 2012 North Bay Road historic, and I just found it impossible to deal with the bureaucracy, so it never got designated. But in any case, in regards to tearing down homes and rebuilding them, the problem I have with a historic home with a teardown is there is so much bad construction here in Miami Beach that was made in the late 70s, 80s, and 90s. Why can't they buy those homes? You know, I mean, on the big strip of North Bay Road, almost everyone has the same view, more or less. I mean, to say that a house would take $42 million to renovate, I did the math. That means that old Phil Collins' house, which is 5800 North Bay Road, it's 11,000 square feet, that house. That means it would be $3,800 a foot to renovate? No, I don't think so. I've renovated about 15 homes myself. They've all been historic. It's a formula. I mean, I think it would be very easy and very posh to renovate that house for even $1,000 a foot, which I think would make it a $1 million renovation. You know, what are there? Windows, baths, kitchen, mechanical, plumbing, electric, roof. No big deal, right? Maybe you want to put extra windows in the back, make it even more beautiful in the back, but certainly preserve the front structure. And not only does it tear the fabric of our community down, it's also a tremendous inconvenience to the neighbors. Who wants construction trucks all up and down your street all the time? Some people, to tear down and build a house, they don't do it in 2 months or 6 months. It's years. That Michael Stern monstrosity on North Bay Road is an eyesore, and it's probably going to go 2 years for construction. And those are the things that, you know, I have issues with. And so does the rest of the community.
So, thank you for those comments.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Do we have anyone else on Zoom?
We have one caller on Zoom, Julie Isaacson. You have 2 minutes.
Okay. Julie?
Morning, everybody. I hope you're well. Excuse me. Sorry, I can't be there in person. I agree with what Jean Marie just said in terms of people coming here and just buying their beautiful historic homes for no, just for the land. It is disgraceful for us to have to put up with the destruction of the character of our neighborhood. And I don't feel sorry for people that are, well, they have to spend this amount of money to renovate. Well, then that's just too bad. Don't buy it here. Buy, like what Doreen Marie said, perhaps some of the newer structures that were, that don't have any specific historic significance. They don't have a significant architect, a historic architect. I just don't understand why, what Sarah said earlier about the enormous amount of demolition requests, and it became even more exponentially huge when the pandemic hit and everybody was trying to get out of Dodge and leave New York and leave the colder climates, et cetera. And now our city is just being destroyed from every single angle. And I think that we need to really step up our game on pre-designating homes that are historic and making it a lot more difficult for historic properties to be approved for demolition. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Thank you, Julie. And that concludes public comment.
Commissioner, I just wanted to explain the $42 million estimate, because I don't want people to think that we just pumped it up and it's just puffing. For these older homes, remember, these older homes were built in the 20s and 30s at a time when contractors were mixing sea salt and sea sand in their concrete. They all have significant spalling issues, so they are not only 2 or 3 feet under current code, but they are also they are structurally deficient. So in order to raise the home, which is a significant cost, and it's not one of the costs that Jean Marie included, in order to raise it 2 or 3 feet, it first needs significant concrete remediation for the home, which means that old bad concrete has to be scraped away. Rebar has to be scraped away or replaced. This is all back-breaking labor and time-consuming. I did it to my house, and I have to tell you, the cost estimate, the cost I actually paid was 2 or 3 times the estimate. It was horrendous. So that is a significant component of the preservation costs if somebody wanted to undertake that.
Okay. Thank you for that. We've concluded public comment. I want a chance to weigh in here a little bit. I haven't had the opportunity, so I appreciate everyone's views. This clearly is a conversation that we want to have, and that's why I believe we should continue. For me, the Al Capone situation elevated the discussion in my mind. You know, Al Capone, for all his notoriousness, is an important figure in history. And, you know, that elevated. I'm not sure there was a simple solution, per se. Looks like the private sector seemed to have worked its way through it. But I think that's an important example from my take. Clearly, there's a conversation to be had. One thing I want to specifically focus on, Tom and Nick, what are the current demolition impact fees we have in place?
I don't believe that there's at least in the LDRs, there's no demolition impact fee. We have fees that are required to go to the DRB. We have DRB application fees. Within the building code, Anna's here. I don't know if there's an impact fee for demolition of the building code. I know that there's fees under the building code for the demolition of a home and the removal of debris, but there's nothing in our city code or our LDRs that would amount to a special fee for demolition or demolition fee.
Is that correct, Anna?
There is in the county code, it does get taken into account. So when you do a total demolition, now it's counted as vacant land. And so then when you rebuild, you pay the impact fees for the new construction. But there's nothing in our code. I had looked to codify something because sometimes with these, they let them become by neglect. And they let the properties on some of the pre-42s, they stop restoring the property so that it becomes a demolition because of an unsafe structure. And I wanted to, back in the day, I had approached someone internally in the city about adding maybe some sort of fines or fees for the ones that have become neglectful and have to be demolished. But they felt that that might incentivize, you know, give people too much of an easy out. But I thought that might be a way to at least disincentivize someone from just doing a total demolition on something and letting it become an unsafe building and demolishing it because of that. Because in the LDRs, there's something that if the building is unsafe, then and the building official deems it unsafe, then it doesn't have to go to all the boards initially. There's a hold placed on the property, but it doesn't have to do those initial steps.
Thank you for that, because that did seem to be something that surfaced as a potential opportunity area worth exploring. And Tom, just for the record, correct me if I'm wrong, before this body met today, there was interest between the DRB and the HPB to have a joint meeting. I don't know if they have a date, but they've been talking about doing that. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, my staff is polling the members of both boards. We've done these meetings in the past. I can tell you from experience, it is very challenging to get both boards together to find a date and time where all 14 members are available. Usually what works the best is one or the other board will agree to make themselves available at the other board's scheduled meeting time, and then there's a time certain assigned. But my staff is going to be polling the board members at the DRB meeting tomorrow, but we are working on trying to establish that joint workshop.
Okay. So, Commissioner Grongora, we're sort of co-sponsors at this moment. There's two of us. Let's see if we can find a path forward. Here's what I think would be a logical next step. I would like to continue this conversation and refer the item to the joint DRB-HPB committee under the scope of what was previously agreed. We are not talking about involuntary. That was not part of this referral. So that scope's in place. We have all the good ideas that the administration brought forward. We're sort of underlining this demolition impact fee. I would like the administration to consider what Michael Larkin mentioned about the unit area, the roof, and maybe the 50% rule to give that consideration. The one additional thing I would say, as I've prepared for this meeting, I hear some people, they just don't know what the rules are. It's sort of a transparency question that I would like in front of that committee. And I would like this to be a fact-driven discussion where the administration can engage with these joint committees, including data of what we know has been happening. I hear anecdotal evidence. I'd like to see actual data. And that we put this in front of that group with that group's view to provide us their joint recommendations traveling back to land use. So I can't make the motion. If that also, if you would like to add or edit, delete, that's where I think we should go.
Let's hear it for 10 okay, seconds.
Okay, quickly here. No.
Could you also direct that the different groups meet, like the private, I don't know if that's something the city could do, but it would be helpful, I think, for the development community and the residents to also sit together, because sometimes it sounds like we do have similar ideas, but we're not always able to come together.
Well, I would just say, you know, we obviously wouldn't direct the parties, but do I think it is beneficial for the parties to engage and meet in a productive format? I would always say that. I think to the extent there's an alignment on things, which I heard a little bit of, that's a goodness. And I'll leave it to Tom and team as to the right process by which the public might provide comment during a joint session.
Yeah, I think that's the whole purpose of the joint DRB-HPB okay. workshop is to allow for public comment.
I'll adopt that as my motion.
Can I, Tom. Can I just clarify, just to make sure I get everything in the motion?
Please.
The first is that we are going to, well, the item will be continued to the following meeting, and Commissioner Samuelin, you will be the new sponsor. Mm-hmm. We will bring back some information regarding the exploration of a demolition fee mm-hmm. that would be within the city code. Mm-hmm. We would explore any amendments to Chapter 54 to include architecturally significant homes within those homes that could potentially get relief. We will report back on the joint DRB and HPB workshop that will take place. With regard to the incentives, we didn't say unit size in the memo, but we did say additional square footage.
Okay.
The only thing I would point out with regard to additional square footage and lot coverage is this, is currently under the code, if you substantially retain and preserve a pre-66 home, not just pre-42, this would apply to homes built before 1966, you can go up to 60% unit size, which is a pretty big home. I don't think we would recommend going above 60%. We can certainly explore a larger number, but that, you know, as the lots get bigger, the homes get significantly bigger. As the lots get smaller, you've got a bigger home and a smaller lot once you get above the 60% threshold like that. So if the committee would like, we can certainly bring back some exploration of that. I think the rooftop activation is a good one. And so I think those would be the four, correct?
Yeah, no, I think that's perfect, Tom. And all of that should be within the scope of the discussion that the joint committee, based on our request, would engage. And then the item will travel back to us once they have had their meeting and can provide us some tangible recommendations.
Okay.
That's great. Thank
you
for all the public. Yeah, thank you for all the public comment. Good discussion. So I think that's great. We've got a couple items. We're going to move quickly here. Item number two, proposed ordinance pertaining to lower impact
medical uses. Tom, in the interest of time, it's my item, so obviously I'm supportive. Could you just give the headline view on what this does? And maybe we've had a little correspondence from West Avenue. I sense there's a degree of support, though they can speak for themselves. But they had a question or two. So if you could touch on that, that'd be great.
This was a dual referral to both the Planning Board and the Land Use and Sustainability Committee. It's scheduled to go before the Planning Board next Tuesday. The administration is highly supportive of this proposal. It was put forth at the request of the owner of the Pure Pharmacy location in the Gumminick Garage on West Avenue, which is an accessory use to that garage. And he had proposed to do a laser hair removal use. And what we discovered in the code is that there was a little bit of a quirk because those were considered Class 1 medical offices. And Class 1 medical offices, for all practical purposes, are not permitted as an accessory use to parking garages, nor are they permitted as an accessory use in buildings in the RM2 and RM3 districts, which are the medium to higher density multifamily districts in the city, unless you are a resident of that building. And so what this ordinance does is it allows for Class 1 medical office uses both as an accessory use to a garage, similar to the way personal service, retail, and restaurant are allowable accessory uses in a parking garage, and it also permits them in the RM2 and RM3 districts for non-residents. And again, that's consistent with the commercial nature of those accessory uses. With regard to the Gumminick Garage, to be very clear and be very specific, this particular use would go at the first floor where the other accessory uses already are. It would not go into areas that are currently occupied by parking spaces, nor will it be replacing parking spaces. In the Gumminick Garage, the entire first floor facing 9th Street, 10th Street, and West Avenue is occupied fully by activated spaces, restaurants, personal services, retail, and there's also a pharmacy there. This would go into one of those bays. So the administration is supportive, and we're seeking the support of the Land Use Committee before next Tuesday's Planning Board meeting.
That's great.
Move the item.
Wonderful. And Nick, is there anyone on Zoom? I don't see anyone here in front of the public.
I see just one hand up.
Sure.
Julie Isaacson.
Okay. Let's make sure it's for Julie, did you want to comment on the item that we're talking about here, number two, the medical uses? Because we've closed the other item. So do you have a comment on number two?
No, I didn't put my hand down before. Sorry.
Okay, no problem. Thank you for your previous comments. So the item has been moved, and Tom will show it done as you described by acclamation. I believe, colleagues, we're the last item and an important one. Anna has been very patient. Update on the building assessment and policy changes. I will say a word to tee this up. We all know the tragedy that we witnessed in Surfside. We all know that the administration has been acting since. We are aware that the body, I think Commissioner Steinberg may have been the sponsor of some items. We've actually taken some action. But I also thought it important that we take a holistic view of the situation. And I think the administration has done a fine job sort of structuring the conversation. It's one, where are we on compliance, sort of what's happening out there? Number two, what other policy changes, you know, may be warranted? What are other municipalities doing? What's the county doing? And number three, what do we need to do organizationally to address this and make sure we're on it? So I thought that was very well thought through, and I would like to have that conversation in turn because they're sort of different buckets. So bucket number one, Anna. Compliance updates. We've seen the memo, but bring it to life, and what do we need to be thinking about?
Well, I'll bring some new numbers because I checked, because it changes a little bit. We're actually at a better place every week that goes by. Currently, we have 43.8%, so almost 44%, that are either completed the process or have an active permit and are moving towards completion of the process. We have 46.7%, which have done portions of the process, but not fully, and we have 9.5% that have just kind of pretended it's not about them. So on the 9.5%, we have, all of those are being escalated to either the Unsafe Structures Board, and we're planning on having the first ones go, start going on Safe Structures Board in December, and we also have a portion of these are also being sent to the special magistrate. We on the 46.7%, some of those have also been noticed already and have been kind of pushed towards the Unsafe Structures Board, and that's really the. I can only hold the hammer and the carrot, and so the carrot is that you get your building recertified. The hammer is, if not, that we're taking you either to the Unsafe Structures Board or to the special magistrate. What we will be recommending and we are pushing is that we do not want to have follow-up dates and updates from the buildings. We want to have timelines and hold them to timelines of actual action. And so that's where we're going as far as the compliance.
Okay. So, and if I may, so because these are distinct topics, I'd like to just weigh in on a couple thoughts and invite my colleague as well. You know, one of the things, building safety is paramount. We want to get that right. And then I always think about the people living in the building. So just could you educate us a little bit, what are the rules as it relates to advising the people in the building? If by chance there's a need for evacuation, what happens? Just start us at square one. What is in place today?
So today what is in place, and it really depends on the emergency. So if there's a fire, we have to evacuate the building and there's really no warning. When we have time, we've been able to give people a month and give them time to note that the building is going to be evacuated, and we have worked with the residents. There is a rule here in the city of Miami Beach, a law, that requires that anyone who is a renter be placed by the person who they rent from. And the renter could be someone who sublets a condo. The condo owner would then be required to find their sublessee a place to live when they're displaced. If not, we do. So that's with anyone who rents. There is a policy that they must be placed. The way it usually works is if it's going to be for a week or less, they can find a hotel for them. Once it's going to be extended beyond a month, usually then what's done is it's a first, last, and security. It's 3 months of rent that is paid to the person to help them find an alternate location. And we have been successful thus far in the buildings that we have had to vacate where everyone did find a home. And so that's important because this is something special to the city of Miami Beach, the fact that they do help with the relocation. And so when we do have to post that we'll have to vacate, I notify the police, we notify the fire department, we notify housing so that we can all start working together. We get whoever is the owner of the unit to sign the owner's agreement form and notify them. We do post the notification if we do need to vacate on the first floor, on every opening into the building, so that anyone who comes in from any of the doors will know what's happening inside the building. When we post those notices say that they cannot be removed. Other notices that we place can be removed by someone. When the notice says this can only be removed by order of the building official, that's so that we make sure that we do give everyone a notification.
If I could pick up on that, because it's very helpful on what the situation is with the renters. What about the transparency issue? How does someone who lives in one of these 420 buildings know whether they're partially completed, whether they're in that 9.5%, how would someone get that information from
the building, the city? How do they know?
They can look up online with the building address on our through our CSS website. All that information is public information, so it's out there. If they know the build with the building address, you can look up any permit that they have in applied status. The 40-year is considered a permit in the way we process it, so you can find the 40-year cases in there. You'd look by address and then search by permit number and the one that would start the 40YR, and you could click in there and see if there's any attachments, if it's been reviewed. All that information is on there. They can contact the building department. We have a phone number to contact us if they need extra information. They can email us. They definitely do. One of the things, and I wanted to kind of briefly touch, because you mentioned that about notifying. And so the Florida Bar recommendations came out earlier, just like last week, on there. They had a policy life safety issues advisory task force, and some of the things that they've required is that buildings that have over 100 units, or that they're recommending, is buildings that have over 100 units have a website and post the information so that it's easier for the unit owners to look, to have a registration, to notify all of the residents, and it can be via email to notify them. And so I think that's some of the stuff that's being codified, which was kind of step two, but I sort of jumped into it.
That's okay. We can go to step two in a second. Commissioner Gong, or anything related to compliance or anything else you want to share just at this juncture?
Sure. There's been a lot discussed. Thank you, Anna, for bringing this forward. Obviously, I've taken a lot of interest in this issue and sponsored a number of discussion items. I had a question on something you mentioned about when there's an issue that the condo owner who has their unit rented out, there's a policy for them to provide alternate housing. It just struck a legal question in my mind. What if there's something in the lease between the parties that says that the owner is not going to do that? Would the city policy override the lease provision? Maybe that's a better question for the attorney's office.
Commissioner, it's a great question. The code provisions that Anna referred to date back to the code of 1964. So, I don't know that we have a policy as to what we would do if there were a lease provision that violated our code. But I would think that if the lease were executed after the code, which is probably any residential lease, that I would think our code would control.
Okay, good to know. This topic is of such interest because obviously you're attending, Anna, on behalf of the City of Miami Beach, the county meetings, which I believe it's chaired by Commissioner Regalado. Is that correct?
Those are separate meetings. I've been to the meetings that Commissioner Regalado has chaired. I've also been to the meetings, the county meetings, that are more technical meetings that actually are the ones that they present. They prepare the presentation for the Commissioner Regalado meetings from a technical level. So the county meetings that are political, that involve more politicians and those kind of meetings that are hosted at the county level, I have participated in, but basically like I'm sitting in the back seat listening. The meetings that I've participated in that are more active are county meetings that we're having that involve several municipalities, building officials from several municipalities, people from the county agencies, people from the Board of Rules and Appeals, and we're looking to see how to unify and present the best information and how to go forward based on what we're hearing and what we think would be the safest thing, course of action going forward. So those meetings are more technical, and then we, based on those meetings, Lourdes Gomez from the county then prepares the presentation that goes to the county meeting. So we're at that meeting. There's that one. There's another meeting that I go to that is only building officials throughout the county. And then that one, we're dealing with the Board of Rules and Appeals and looking at how to adjust the application process and how to maybe, because the 40-year form has been around for a long time, how to codify things to make it a little stricter the requirements for reporting and what type of information should be on those reports. And so to hopefully up that level also.
Thank you. I mean, there's so many ideas. A lot of people have talked about shortening the period to 30 years and every 10 years thereafter. People have talked about becoming a little stricter on who can perform which particular areas of certification. Right now, I think it's any licensed architect or engineer. So there have been talks about being a little bit stricter in those regards and a number of other ideas. And you're right, everybody's talking about this. You have the county political body. You have the County Board of Rules and Appeals, Bora, more building official oriented. I think our fire chief is also on that board, if I'm not mistaken. Virgil Fernandez. You have the Florida Bar, who's issued a task force of attorneys, who on October 12th issued a report that also touches on some of these issues and makes some legislative changes, mostly at the state level, but I think a couple of things that local government could also implement that perhaps Commissioner Samuelin or one of the remaining commissioners would want to look into. I personally have taken a big interest, and I'm looking to get more involved in these issues at the county level now that I'm going to be segueing away from my commission role. I do want to take the opportunity to plug and highlight two things that I'm going to be participating in. I've been asked to co-chair a committee at the Miami Beach Chamber with Calvin Coley, and we are having our first meeting open to the public this Thursday morning at 9 a.m. at the Chamber via Zoom or live appearance. It's a hybrid meeting similar to our commission meetings. But more so, since I have Anna here, I am also appearing in a governmental town hall with Anna, our building director and official, Spencer Hennings, the Florida condo ombudsman, and Commissioner Regalado from the county, who is pushing a lot of condo changes and legislation. That will be Thursday at 5:30 at the Miami Beach Regional Library, and you can find out more information at my office. I do agree with Commissioner Samuelin that one of the most important things is notice to condo owners. A lot of residents just have no idea what's happening. Mm-hmm. A lot of times because they don't attend any of their meetings or follow up with anything that their buildings are doing. So then they're shocked to learn that their building may be going through a certification or receives a red tag, or worse, that they may be sent to the Unsafe Structures Board. So I think anything we can do to provide more notice is helpful. I think Commissioner Minor has an item to that effect running through the Neighborhoods Committee presently. I also had a question when you said we're preparing to host the first Unsafe Structures hearing in Miami Beach in December, because the Unsafe Structures Board is a county board. Is that going to be only Miami Beach cases, or is it going to be their regular meeting countywide just conducted here from Miami Beach?
So the plan was to host the meeting here in December. However, there's been some back and forth. We would be hosting a Miami Beach only meeting.
Okay.
So the... we have, in 2015, there was an ordinance passed that allowed us to host, and so we are hosting for the county. It's still the county's meeting, as far as the people that come are from the county's meeting, and that's where there's been a little legal sticking points. And so we are definitely going to be going to Unsafe Structures in December, whether it's here or it's at the county's Unsafe Structures Board. The idea was to try to get it here, but right now we're feeling like it's probably not going to happen by then, because there started to be some little legal sticking points. So we're then submitting all our forms and all our paperwork to the county to get it in the December hearings.
And if this is only Miami Beach matters, is there a way to publicly get this meeting shown, or is there a way for people from the public to be able to view it? Is it on Zoom or some other channel?
Yeah, we're going to have the meetings. They're going to be here at City Hall, and when we have the meetings up, they will be hybrid meetings, I think, the way pretty much every meeting has become at this point. So, yes.
Okay. And then finally, one of the ideas that's been floated right now, as I understand it, there's only two municipalities in the county that have their own Unsafe Structures Board, the City of Miami and the City of Miami Gardens. I know that Miami Beach has talked about potentially creating our own as one of the ideas to help deal with these cases a little bit quicker, because I read an article in the Herald, I think, that the Unsafe Structures Board has a backlog of like 1,000 cases, so it's taking a long time for these matters to get heard. Is there any movement on that idea?
Well, that's the idea that we've been working on, and actually what we have it already codified. It's from 2015. The only thing that we're doing right now is that the county, different people in the county have given different directions. So at this point, the last thing that our legal advisor was told was to reach out to the city of Miami and see how they set it up. So he's been reaching out to the city of Miami, but it's, again, it's asking someone questions and waiting for them to get the right answers from them. So my goal was that we'd have all this taken care of. It seemed like it was flowing, and then we kind of hit a little hiccup with the county, and so we're reaching out to city of Miami and finding out exactly what the deal is that they got so that we can get the same deal.
Okay. Well, thank you. This is an issue. Building safety is so important in a city like Miami Beach, where more than half of our residents reside in multifamily dwelling buildings, whether those be condos, apartments, co-ops, what have you. So I'm sure that we will continue to have this on many agendas going forward, and I look forward to being a part of that discussion to make our buildings even safer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Gungor. And just following up that meeting, Anna, which I know is still in flux, the Building Safety Board in Miami Beach, seems like a great opportunity to educate and reach out to the community. I assume we would provide proper notice. Perhaps our communications department could help. I would also just ask, you know, would there be an opportunity for yourself or folks from your department to be present even as a follow-up to that? Because you may have a lot of people in the room with questions. Is that something we could consider?
Yeah, I'm confused.
Well, no. not the building. No, people are going to come, right? If we bring that to people's awareness, that's probably going to capture the interest of a lot of people.
Yes. And definitely, we've done community outreach on every topic that we cover, because that's the easiest way, I think, to get the message out there. And with the 40 year, we did two community outreaches immediately explaining what we were looking for. And now that there was the other legislation changed again, we did two community outreaches. We try to do one earlier in the morning, one later in the day. And we do them via Teams or Zoom meetings so that everyone can participate. And we take questions and we do that. Yeah, so once we'd get to a point where we'd be hosting for sure, and we would provide, we have always provided it, so I see no reason why we wouldn't now.
Perfect. Yes. That's exactly what I was hoping to hear. From a policy standpoint, we could spend hours, Commissioner Gongora in his last meeting doesn't want me to even say things like that, but we could spend hours going through all this today. I don't think that's where we're at right now. Is there anything you need from this body? Is there any policy change for the city of Miami Beach that you would like to sort of elevate that we could actually either engage on today or at our next discussion?
Well, I think one of the ones which had to do with reporting was already brought up and has already been codified by the city. And that's one that I know that is being worked on at the county level and at the state level. I also think that there are some issues that we might want to discuss the recommendations of the Florida Bar, because some of them really have to do with how the condo provides information to its residents, because everything I do already is public record. So we have it on our website. We have it available. People may not know how to find it, but it's there. But sometimes with the condominiums, it's not as readily available. And I think those are the types of things that you may want to look at as a body, at that type of the need to notify the residents, because we can put placards everywhere. I can notify people, we can put signs. However, if then the people in charge don't have a place for them to look up the information, the only thing they have to do is come back here and ask.
And so,
sure. And I skimmed the report. I haven't had time to peruse it completely yet. But right now, Florida law requires buildings of a certain size, I think it's 150 units or more, to have a website where they upload all of their documents. So I did notice that one of the suggestions from the Florida Bar was lowering that to include mid-sized buildings with smaller budgets. Because it has proved to be a good tool in these larger buildings, because people can't say they don't have the info. It's on a website. So if they're not accessing it, then, you know, it kind of becomes shame on them. So I think that is one of the points that they are recommending. And I think that's something that's probably going to happen at the state law level, because it's currently part of the state statute in 718.
Yeah. So those are the type. I think that kind of notification is the type of thing that we'd want to would want to look at as a governing body, and to make sure, because and to also make sure that I'm following the rules, so I can come back with reports on a regular basis.
Yeah, and my intent was to keep this at this moment in time as a standing item, because we have the compliance related issues which are changing by the minute. I think the next time we talk, based on exactly what you said, Anna, that we would engage a bit more on that notice issue, the one you just talked about that's coming through the state, and see if there's anything from a municipal standpoint we should do. And then obviously if there are needs of your department, I know they would go through the normal protocols, but, you know, I want to also offer this body as a sounding board. You know, we need to make sure we have everything in place to do this right. So I just want to highlight that. And so with that, is there anything else anyone wants to share? I would like to bring this back to the next land use meeting with sort of that direction and focus.
So we'll continue this to the next land use meeting.
Absolutely. Anna, thank you. That was very helpful. And Commissioner Gongora, as I started the meeting with the well wishes, I will conclude and thank you again for your service to this committee. We will carry on as best we can, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for that. I'm sure that you all will do great, and it's been wonderful serving with you all.
Wonderful. With that, the meeting is adjourned.